Hi, this is Doug Podell. Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. Don't forget, while you're online, to check out the Riff Concert page. It's the Motor City's best for complete rock concert information. For more details, just click on the Riff banner on your Windows Media Player.
Joe Kane on WRIF Riff Rocks.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Welcome, everybody. It's been a couple of weeks, so, man, I'm glad to get back on the air, and I'll be glad to hear from you at 313-298-WRIF. Hey, did you hear me about 30 seconds ago doing a DJ thing? Man, I haven't done DJ work on WRIF in years and years. Just doing the talk show. Well, I shouldn't say just. I mean, it's an honor. It's a privilege. And yet, I always love DJing on this station as well. If you're listening from somewhere, yeah, not in Detroit, you don't know the Riff, as we call WRIF, check it out at WRIF.com. And there's also, what the hell is the other point? Now I stuck myself. There's one of these digital deals, too, that you can hear on your computer. Sorry, boss, that I sort of lost it there for a second. But I haven't done this in a couple of weeks. Christmas and then New Year's. Christmas Day, New Year's Day. Just didn't do it. Although at 11 o'clock Christmas day night, we played a couple of interviews that I had previously recorded. But I guess this happens, what, every 7 years? Must. Doesn't it kind of travel along? I mean, leap year, I don't know. But anyways, glad to be back with you. And so the good news is we're all back together. We're doing Night Call. You're calling 313-298-WRIF. And the bad news is I do it next week, and then I'm gone for another couple of weeks. I'm heading down to Venezuela, Caracas. I'm going to say hello to Hugo Chavez, man. Yeah, you know, if Bush hates him, I'm there. I'm going to shake his hand and say, Senor Chavez, you're a cool dude. Because he's been doing some good stuff for his people, good stuff for the poor people in the United States. A lot of you know that he's, how do I get into these things? I was going to do something entirely different. But now that I'm just sort of going off on that, if I can find this quickly. Oh, yeah, oil. Chavez is giving oil to countries, the poorer countries in the Caribbean basin, all those island nations and what have you, and also to poor people in Boston and in New York that are having trouble meeting, having ends meet because of you know, the cost of oil. I mean, instead of ExxonMobil getting rich, Chavez is taking this oil money and using it for his country to help the poor there and helping the poor around the country. I'm sorry, around the world. And get this, though. The Chicago Transit Authority, that's who runs the buses and the buses and the trains, the elevated trains. And for those of you, a little side note for you classic rockers, the band Chicago was initially called Chicago Transit Authority. In fact, they even called it CTA, which is the initials for the bus company. And they sued the band, saying, hey, wait, you can't use this. So they just changed it to simply Chicago. Anyways, they're refusing an opportunity to alleviate commuting costs for hundreds of thousands in the Windy City's low-income neighborhoods. Instead of accepting deeply discounted fuel from the Venezuela-owned Citgo Petroleum Corporation, the city is instead raising fares to solve budget shortfalls. Now, a lot of you don't even know that, but when you buy Citgo gas, you're buying Venezuelan gas. This money goes back into Venezuela, and then it's distributed much more equitably. Rather than just making a bunch of rich people a lot richer off of poorer people and middle-class people, like when you buy ExxonMobil products and all that, it actually is doing something decent in the world. I mean, as decent as oil, this vile fluid that causes wars and pollution and all that, can do. I mean, we're there now, so I mean, personally, we ought to be doing is thinking how to get off of oil. But anyways, in October, these Citgo people said that they would provide Chicago with low-cost diesel fuel. The company's stipulation, they said, that was at the bidding of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Now, he knew what was going on in Chicago. He knew that the Chicago Transit Authority was running at a deficit, and he knows that poor people depend on public transportation in Chicago to get to their jobs or medical stuff or wherever, and he knows that the prices of public transportation is so high that it cuts deeply into the income of poor people. So, feeling for the poor, he said, I'm going to give the city of Chicago deeply discounted diesel oil to run the Chicago buses. So what did Chicago do? They said they have no intent or plan to accept the offer. And instead, in place of the proposed discount, which the CTA apparently does not want Chicagoans to even know about. Where is this from here? This is from something called Venezuelan Analysis. Venezuela Analysis. Venezuela Analysis. It's .com. Yeah. Let's see. The Chicagoans are unaware of the offer, and they're going to be hit with an increase of 25 cents per ride next month, and a discounted route-to-route transfers will be eliminated for passengers paying cash. So, 25 cents, a big deal. That's a big deal when you're poor. Remember, the poorer you are, the poorer your gross income, the more these little things count. So, if you're middle class and gas, which is going up again, is $2.40 a gallon almost, you're kind of grumbling. You know, I do. But if you're making $13,000 a year, suddenly the gas, which went up 40%, how come we got an oil man or a bunch of oil men in the White House and the price of gasoline goes up 40% last year, 2005? Oh, yeah, that's right. That's why it went up. Sorry. Didn't figure that out for a second. This is Night Call, by the way, 313-298-WRIF. And in this article, they're talking about these people that are spending a good portion of their total income, people that make $560 a month. I mean, there's probably any number of you that are saying, yeah, that's what I make. Well, it's pretty tough. It's a tough way to go. But let me go off in the way that I originally intended. Many of you know that myself and some others broadcast this nationally syndicated program on the IE America Radio Network. Not to be confused with Air America that's operating now, but this began in 2000. I was on it for about 3.5 years doing a daily show that was broadcast in a number of cities around the country. And it was particularly right after September 11th, but even before, when I was critical and other talk show hosts on the network were critical of George Bush, saying that he stole the election, that he was a liar and stuff like that, we'd lose affiliates. People say, you can't talk about the President of the United States like that. And after September 11th, the hammer really came down, really lost a lot of stations. And I began calling, I mean, one of my colleagues called the Bush administration the Bush crime family. So I couldn't take that one. So I called it something a little softer and gentler, Bushco, Bush Incorporated, essentially a business racket that had taken over the United States government and was operating it for the corporations, by the corporations, and literally of the corporations. And we will talk about that in half a second. It's not always pleasant when things that you say that have been denied and they come true and you can say, oh, I told you so. You don't want to say, when you're talking about the dangers of nuclear war or nuclear power and then something awful happens, you're not happy when you say, I told you so. But and this doesn't sound very modest, but I did tell you so. And I'm not the only person in America that knew all this, that knew that that almost everything that Bushko said was a lie. The wars were a lie. The energy stuff was a lie. The environmental stuff, and on and on and on and on like that. And now, it, of course, it's becoming to be exposed as a total 100% racket. This Jack Abramoff scandal, this is the lobbyist who has been pleading guilty, and probably is going to take down a whole lot of Republicans with him because it's a purely Republican racket. I used to say, and actually I used to piss off my bosses in the United Auto Workers who own the previous network that I worked on because they were, like, uncritical of the Democrats, not publicly at least. And so I would say the Democrats were the other half of the ruling racket. Well, they've been cut out. I mean, they still get corporate money and stuff like that, but nothing. Nothing of the scope that now flows into the Republicans and nothing of the deep corruption that is going on with these Republicans. And these folks, and we've talked about the arrogance level, are so arrogant that they barely try to disguise any of this. If you think of Tom DeLay, the disgraced former speaker or majority leader in the House, the Republican majority leader, I mean, anybody could see the connection he had and the riches that he was reaping, and this Duke Cunningham was building this mansion, and this is only the tip of the iceberg. Hear this: presidential aides, I. Abramoff visits aide to President George W. Bush. This is from UPI. Pardon me, are trying to identify all photos that may exist of showing the president and lobbyist Jack Abramoff together. They probably will send him over to the Ministry of Truth. Remember your 1984 George Orwell. And send it down the memory hole. Time magazine reported Sunday that administration officials, bracing for the worst, obtained from the Secret Service a list of all the times Abramoff entered the White House complex and were scrambling to determine the reason for each visit. Well, why the hell do you think he was in there? He was bringing the word to probably mostly to Cheney. Bush was dithering, doing something that didn't have anything to do with why he's supposed to be there. Telling Cheney, you know, who is the godfather, essentially, what legislation had to be put in place because of the payoffs, right? Let's see. Abramoff attended Hanukkah, and because he's an Orthodox Jew, he says he's disgraced his creator. You ever notice how these guys get so contrite, like this Duke Cunningham? Pardon me, he was crying and all this. I mean, if they hadn't got caught, they just would have been riding high. They would have just been sucking down the millions. And I mean, they were so arrogant. They left this not a paper trail, but a digital trail. This was all on emails, making fun of the people that had given the millions, the Indian people. Let's see, attendant Hanukkah services, said an aide who had seen the list. Press Secretary Scott McClellan said Abramoff might have attended large gatherings with Bush, but added, the president does not know him, nor does the president recall ever meeting him. We shall see. Eh? Okay. Let's talk about how Bushko, the racket rather than government that rules us now, winds up in death. Of course, we know in Iraq it's mass death. 12 American GIs have died in a helicopter crash. Support our oops, right? In addition to 5 in combat, support our oops. And now what is it up to? 2,199 men and women have died on our side. 30,000 to 100,000 of Iraqis have died. U.S. strike on home kills 9 in family in Baji, including women and young children. They thought that they saw people digging, and then they went into this house. So what the hell do? You bomb it, right? Support our oops, dead kids. All right. Anyways, right today, the 12 miners' families from the West Virginia accident were, and let's hold this word accident in abeyance. You know, there's not 35,000 deaths from accidents from automobiles. They know this is going to happen. It's just sort of random who's going to wind up to fill those 35,000 spots. Or is it? Hopefully it's down below that. But so it's kind of hard to really say that they're automobile accidents. You and I may have an individual accident, but in the aggregate look of automobile transportation, it's not an accident. They know that 35,000 people are going to get killed, a couple million are going to be injured, a few billion in property damage. If someone tried to introduce a machine like that, think about that. I got this new machine. It's going to really help people. Cool. Any side effects? Well, it's going to kill about 350,000 people every decade. It's going to cost probably $500 billion in property damage and injury stuff. But, yeah, it would never fly. But we're stuck with it. I have one, even. Well, the miners, same thing. There were, like Katrina, before Katrina, there were all these cutbacks. There were cutbacks on enforcement of mining rules. I mean, I think anybody who's been paying attention knows this, that this mine had dozens or was it hundreds even of violations, and sort of these corporations are Murder Incorporated. They kind of think, well, let's see, how much is it going to cost us to not get cited? Not very much. How much would it cost to put in the safety stuff? Millions. And besides, we've got the fox guarding our chicken coop, because who Bush appointed to be head of mine safety when he came in was the guy who was head of the mining industry lobbyists. So he came in, pardon me, gutted enforcement, and then went back to being a lobbyist. I mean, that's how that goes, right? And so it's not just an accident. It's not just an accident that occurred. But the big thing that we ought to, well, I don't know. There's just too much here. It's got me stammering. Because if you think about it, pick up a paper, look at Yahoo News, go to the New York Times site, and it's staggering. I can't even marshal all this information into my brain. I mean, I always say this is a one-man show, but I'm not copping to that. I don't know how anybody could. It's like scandal du jour, I mean, every day. Now, here is an article. It says, according to this poll, most of us in the U.S. say that the government should have a warrant to snoop. Majority of Americans want the Bush administration to get court approval before eavesdropping on people inside the United States, even if those calls might involve suspected terrorists. Well, it's not so unusual that that would be the case, because there is the easy ability to get these through the foreign intelligence. See, it's not in front of me. I can't remember what it is. Don't even bother to tell me. It's FISA, F-I-S-A. There are these secret courts. We've never had secret courts before, but we've had them in order to deal with intelligence and to make sure that the executive branch doesn't overstep its authority. The only government that's ever been refused, you got to remember, these are like conservative federal judges that are issuing these or refusing Bush. Now, if there, you say, what if there's an emergency? I don't care about the Constitution. What if some guy's going to blow up our city? Who the hell cares about secret courts or FISA laws or anything, right? I just don't want any damn terrorist taking out his grievances on me in the United States that can't even figure out what these people are doing in the Middle East or why the hell we're even there. So tap them, torture them, who cares, right? Just don't let me or my family or my community or my nation suffer what we did on September 11th. However, as it turns out, if there's something really pressing that the government, the executive branch, Bush, can tap right away, find out. And what do they do then? Within 72 hours, they can go into the FISA court, the secret court, and say, look, we just did this, and we did it because this was an emergency. And they can say, cool. And they always have said, okay. But right now, there's no way to tell who the surveillance was on. Could it have been on Bush Co.'s political enemies? A sort of electronic or digital Watergate. Remember Watergate? They broke into the Democratic Party's headquarters. That's what it's all about. That's what started the unraveling of the Nixon regime, the Nixon criminal gang. Who Dick Cheney says he wants to go back to that era. when the government not only spied on people regularly, but it set people up for murder. It surveilled the most innocent political dissent. These are extraordinarily dangerous people that we now have shredding our Constitution. One of the reasons... Oh, by the way, so let me see the figures here. 56% of us said... where are we? 56% said that the government should get a warrant. 42% said they did not believe the court approval... those surveys do not believe the court approval is necessary. Well, it's necessary under the law, but forgetting about that... Man, I hate the winter. Bush said, we are at war. This is total BS. We are not at war. There's no war been declared. There is nothing approaching a war. I mean, there's a war in Iraq. But we're not at war with terrorists. You cannot be at war with a bunch of criminal civilians. You know what a terrorist is, right? Someone with a bomb who doesn't have an air force. Peter Werby's my name. Night calls the show. 313-298-WRIF. But you know what? So this is pretty good. You think the people are getting fooled less and less about fooling all the people some of the time. This isn't happening anymore. People are on to Bush Co. They know if they say A, it's actually B. They know this is a lying criminal administration that's attacking our Constitution. And therein lies the important deal. Because even if 98% of us said, I don't think George Bush needs a warrant to monitor our calls, to investigate people that are dissenting from the official government line, opening mail, opening our medical and library and book buying habits and all that, it doesn't matter. The Constitution of the United States is not set up for a popularity poll. I mean, fortunately, people aren't that dumb. I mean, apparently, what was it, 42% are. They don't understand the Constitution. That's very, very scary. I mean, here's what Bush says, by the way. He said, terrorists want to use Iraq as a home base. I'm not making this up. Wasn't it Nixon that said, I'm not a crook? This is right there. He says, terrorists want to use Iraq as a home base. Well, we've seen to that. It wasn't a home base for terrorists at all, zero, until Bush sent our men and women over there to be killed. And we are pumping up soon to another 9/11 death toll from, not from terrorists, some, but also just from the insurgents, Iraqi people that don't want us there. But he says, I'm not making this up. All right. Let's take a look at the Constitution and how Bush is shredding it. If you've got something to add, please call me, 313-298-WRIF. First Amendment, which mostly we always talk about. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Big headlines. Minister, a Bush ally, gives church as a site for Judge Alito rally. This is a guy that is far, 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 far right wing that Bush is trying to put on the Supreme Court, if you don't know that. Reverend Herbert H. Luss II is a maverick black minister who took to his pulpit in Philadelphia in 2000 and pledged his support for the Bush presidency. Well, people have a right. You know, there's some black Republicans, not very many, but a few. Why did Mr. Lusk do that? He received $1 million grant through the president's new religion-based initiative to run a housing program for the poor. Now, Lusk may not care about any of this. He's got homeless people as people get poorer and poorer, led by the people who traditionally are the poorest, the people of color. So he figures, the hell, who cares? I'm getting $1 million for these guys. The Democrats respect the Constitution about establishment of religion and can't give me any money. I'm going to take taxpayer money and give it to a religious program. But whatever, or maybe it's just a pure racket. I have no idea. But the Founding Fathers, and let's get back to why they wrote what they did and why they did everything so specifically. I mean, there's very little written, particularly in that time in the 18th century, about governments. It was all done by tradition. It was all the absolute rule sanctified by religion and tradition. All right. So there was starting to be some written documents and what have you, the Magna Carta. Did they have anything in the English Revolution of 1688? I don't know. But anyways, they figured it was a good idea, given how monstrous government had acted since its inception, of absolute rule, of the religion being an integral part of the state, of essentially government being a mechanism whereby it looted the classes below it, and also religion sanctified this looting process, and the deification of the ruler. I mean, that's the function of religion in its direct connection with the state, and the political state was a racket to rob the other classes and also to raise armed men. So if anybody really got uppity about the fact that they were being screwed by the rulers, they would just be killed. Okay, that's the short course on that. The Founding Fathers knew all this, and they knew that the most dangerous institution to pursue, what was it, liberty, well, I can't remember what it is, happiness, liberty, pursuit of happiness. You know that little Declaration of Independence. I'll think of it in a second, don't bother even to write me. But that the biggest enemy of all that was the institution of government, so they wanted to put in place all these protections. So when you read the Bill of Rights, they are responding to thousands of years of tyrannical government history that they're trying to stop. So when people violate this, like Bushko is, you are on the road to exactly what was before us, feudalism. I mean, when are you going to have to get a clue? When they order us to thatch our roofs or to doff our caps when the rulers walk by? Or when they just throw everybody in jail who they don't like? I mean, they're halfway there. Anyways, all right, so that's the First Amendment. There's certainly been a lot of violations of the right of the people to peacefully assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. That's the first one as well. Now, the whole spying thing violates the Fourth Amendment. The right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause. That means supervision. There's no asterisk there. It doesn't say in times of terror. It doesn't say if George W. Bush says we're at war. It's absolute. And that's what they wanted. Okay? All right. So they broke the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment. By the way, Bushko may have screwed up the prosecutions of authentic terrorists or people that are financing terrorists. Because now defense lawyers in some of the country's biggest terrorism cases say they plan to bring legal challenges to determine whether the National Security Agency used illegal wiretaps against several dozen Muslim men tied to Al-Qaeda. Now, what's going to happen? They're going to go into court, and they're going to say, I want to see these wiretaps. And Bushko is going to say no, and they'll dismiss the charges against these guys. There's a famous case that happened in Ann Arbor, which I won't even bother to document. But that's why John Sinclair of the White Panther Party, Pun Plamondon, some of you remember this, some of you won't have a clue what I'm talking about. That's how they got their case tossed. The government was tapping everybody in the whole Detroit, Cass Corridor, Wayne State, University of Michigan area in order to get something on these radicals. And they got something on the tape, but then the lawyers said, we want your tapes. We want to see how extensive your taping is. The government kicked the case. They said, we're not showing you. So the same thing could happen here. Their opening letters, a 81-year-old retired University of Kansas history professor got a letter back that was that he'd sent to a fellow professor, retired professor in the Philippines. It said it resealed with a strip of dark green tape bearing the words, by border protection, carrying the official Homeland Security seal. All right, the Sixth Amendment, which says, how many people know that? In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury. Now, this guy, Jose Padilla, didn't they decide that it's sort of the Americanization of, it's not Padilla, it's Padilla, detained for over 3 years without charges, an enemy combatant. He's an American. He was arrested in the United States, appeared in court for the first time being flown to Miami from a military prison. Aren't they going to kick this case on the Sixth Amendment, that he didn't get a speedy trial? And they say, wait a minute, maybe this guy, well, and they dropped all this stuff about dirty bomb. Now they're saying he was part of preparing for some attacks. He was against the U.S., and he was part of an Al-Qaeda support unit. Well, the deal is that courts kick things completely. Like, for instance, if you confess and then they find out that the cops beat the crap out of you, like they used to do regularly in the big cities around the country and probably the rural areas as well, and they just do irregularly now, it still happens. But they throw it out. They throw it out. That's what they call a technicality. But they know if they let, what's the word? Not toxic evidence, but, God, I can't think of the word. But evidence that's been tainted evidence, tainted by constitutional violations, that it opens the door to the executive branch to do what the founding fathers were trying to protect against. So Padilla is a candidate for walking free because of the violation of the Sixth Amendment by Bushko. If this guy was involved in something like he was going to set off some dirty bomb in Chicago, why the hell didn't they just bring him to trial 2 days later? Maybe they didn't have any good evidence. See, that's the deal. This guy's been in solitary confinement for 3 years. So we have no idea. I mean, you might be saying, screw him, he's a terrorist. But we have no idea. Might have been wrong place, wrong guy. This has happened. People wind up in Guantanamo Bay, and it turns out, yeah, sorry about that. We kept you for 3 years, and we just made a mistake. How about the Eighth Amendment? Do you know that? You know that thing? I didn't think so. I mean, if someone would have been doing this to me, I couldn't either. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Well, it's quite clear the United States has become a torture state and involves beastly tortures to people all over the world, from Afghanistan to Guantanamo to Iraq. Number of people have been tortured to death. I mean, not having their nails pulled up, but beaten to death. And there's been ample evidence of this. And Bush finally was required to sign a torture ban. Remember, this was John McCain and 93 senators signed on board to it. Mostly all the Republicans, just a few of the far right-wing wacko presidents senators said, yeah, you know, we torture people. So finally he agreed to do it. But there's this new little deal that they call a signing statement. And he signed it and said this, where is this in here, that this will not in any way construe, or the executive branch shall construe the law in a manner consistent with the constitutional authority of the president as commander-in-chief and for protecting the American people from further terrorist attacks. So that's like saying, I swear, I swear, I swear, and then you've got your fingers crossed behind your back. So the torture of people in violation of U.S. law, in violation of international law, disgracing our nation because, this does not work. People say, what if they were going to bomb New York with 4 atomic bombs? Would you not torture them? You know what? They would be, whatever would have to be done, would be done to them. I mean, that's not a problem. Man, I could just go on and on and on like this. But these people are a menace to our constitutional system. And when you have Cheney, who runs things, saying that he admires the Nixon era, what are we doing to rid the country of the most severe challenge it may have had since the Civil War? I mean, well, there's enough starting to rustle around for impeachment. And you can go to johnconyers.com, is it? And you go to my website, peterwerbe.com, peterwerbe.com, and that'll give you all the information on impeachpack.org, how people are beginning to understand that there has been high crimes and misdemeanors committed. And this is not a president getting a BJ and lying about it. This is goes to the heart of the constitutional system. George W. Bush, on 4 separate occasions, said, my favorite form of government is a dictatorship. And then he laughed, because he was only kidding. We'll be right back to get your calls. Hang on.
This is WRIF.com.
Tired of expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum of $30. And for the unlimited packages, it's anywhere from $40 to $70. After adding all the taxes and fees, the question is it really worth it? I'd like to introduce you to Corecom's new product, Voice Over Internet Protocol, or simply VoIP. This innovation allows you to talk to anyone around the world by using your broadband internet connection. With its advanced features, VoIP is revolutionizing telephone service as we know it today. Even more exciting is that this can all be done at a fraction of the price of traditional phone service. Why would you pay more when you can pay less? If you've got high-speed internet access, Corecom can offer you a package for as low as $15.99 per month. When was the last time your phone company offered you any package options that low? As an added bonus, if you call within the next next 10 minutes, CoreCom will throw in 1 month free. All you have to do is call 1-866-680-CORE. That's 1-866-680-CORE. Call now and mention promotion code WRIF, or if you register online, type in promotion code WRIF to get your free month. CoreCom, revolutionizing phone service, one call at a time.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Hey, a short spot break. It's going to be the way we go all night. After the first, all the advertisers are exhausted. Probably they've spent all their money. Anyways, if you're just joining me, I am not going to recapitulate. I'm not going to recap the way you're supposed to because I was just on a rave. So let's get to some of the people that have been waiting patiently. Here's Tom in St. Clair Shores. Hey, Tom, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Good to hear you again.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to – you've heard from me several times. I'm sure you know who I am, and I usually ream on you. But, I'm sitting here in my office. I run a local business. I sit down and I listen to the local music, usually from, the show before you. And so you kind of bleed into the next hour, and as I'm doing my books, I just cannot help it. You just generally get my hackles up.
Good.
And
well, again, go ahead. What hackles did I get up? It says you want to talk
about it again tonight. But well, first I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to agree with you because, believe me, I am not a Bush fan whatsoever. I think we're totally wrong at this war, and something that I know that you will probably agree with me, I was reading on the Internet tonight. I don't watch TV, so all my information comes to me via the Internet. And one of the captions on Yahoo tonight was, this nifty new fad of getting this implant under your skin to wave your hand over your front door to let you in and all this nifty stuff that's associated with it. And just like the mark of the beast, I know you don't believe in the Bible, and neither do I. I'll be first to tell you I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
But here it comes, brother, the mark of the beast. You know, and they're going to sell it to us on security. And of all things, the guy that was reading or writing or interviewed in this article says, yeah, he lives in New York. If I was to be found naked in an alley or if I was naked in an alley, I'd want to be able to get into my house.
Oh, my God. Well, tell me, hey, Tom, we don't got a lot of time. Tell me about Chavez that you told our phone screen.
Yep, that's what I was going to talk about. You know, you sit here and you talk about how Chavez is such a good guy, and you do realize. Again, I'm not...
Go ahead. Just give me the premise.
Well, I'm asking you, why do you think these religious rights are so against him? We have put him in power, basically. He was a tyrant.
Wait. He was never a tyrant. How do you figure he was a tyrant? He won all these Democratic elections. He won a referendum. His popularity by every poll is like 70%. All the UN inspectors and Jimmy Carter and all those people said the elections are fair.
Okay, you know why he's giving that oil away? Have you read any of the articles where the people in his own country are absolutely totally sabotaging the oil wells and anything to do with oil pipelines? He had no choice but to kiss their butts and do something like that.
Well, I mean, listen, I believe in the old, talking about classic rock earlier, the old Bob Dylan things, or the old Bob Dylan line from, Subterranean Homesick Blues, don't follow leaders, watch your parking meter. So I don't want to make Chavez or anybody into a saint. Obviously, there's more to it than him just helping the poor and all that. It's very complex. Every governmental situation is very complex. There's always negatives. I mean, pumping all that oil in Venezuela does great harm to the environment. It does great harm to the native people in those regions. And on the other hand, he seems on the face of it to be a fairly sincere guy that cares about people, the poor in his country. And he seems then, he's called a populist, which is, remember we looked that up in a dictionary, and it was someone who respects the right and power of the people. And is he using it for personal gain? Who knows? I mean, anybody wants to be the leader of a country. It's got to be a little wacky, I mean, I think. But whatever. All right, got to move on. Thanks, Tom. Take care of your books. Here is Joe's in Walled Lake. Joe, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Are you with me? Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, you know, I've enjoyed the rights of freedom free. I've never fought for our rights or did anything of that way. I just can't I can't believe that these people did what they did to our country, and something had to be done about it. I can't believe that you wouldn't agree with that. Something had to be done about this.
About what? About what?
The fact that they attacked. We never went to war until they attacked us. Am I correct?
Who is us?
America. They bombed the World Trade Center.
No. I meant. Who is they?
The Arabs, the Bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, the people who bombed the World Trade Center.
Joe, you still are possessed of the belief that Iraq had anything to do with 9/11? 15 of the bombers were from our ally, Saudi Arabia. Bush himself has admitted there's never been the slightest connection with Al-Qaeda and Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction. You're not keeping abreast of...
No, I'm not talking about mass destructions. I'm talking about a number of 16 to 20 people who
were on the planes. Yeah. But what country? What country were they? The guys from Saudi Arabia.
Who did? Who attacked our World Trade Center? Tell me.
The guys from Saudi Arabia. The guy that planned it, Osama bin Laden, is from Saudi Arabia, and 15 of the 19 men who were on the plane were from Saudi Arabia. That we didn't attack them. We attacked the country next to it. Maybe Bushco, which can never seem to do anything right, just got the wrong country. Maybe they just made a little mistake like that. All right, thanks, Joe. Let's see here. Here's Michael in Westland. Michael, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing great, Michael. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. I have a few brief comments I'd like to share with the...
The polls, he would have, in Ohio, he would have lost Ohio and would have lost the election. So,
Peter, let me clarify myself.
Okay.
I had to realize why would people vote for him in the first place, somebody that is destroying and ruining our country, and the answers that I've come to are very disturbing.
What's that?
Much like the Nazis, the Bushco, Bush Incorporated, whatever you want to phrase them, they are gaining power through propaganda through the media.
Now, don't you think the media is finally doing its job fairly decently? Also, you got to remember, Michael, that the Democrats are such a poor alternative. If they would have had somebody running for John, or if John Kerry would have run on a forthright platform and not equivocated, whether you want to call it flip-flopping, but done a million things trying to please his advisors rather than using common sense and knowing that the American people were getting way tired of Bush, Kerry would be the president now. I mean, Bush only won by under 2%, 2 percentage points.
Peter, the
Michael,
flip-flop was a distortion, was misinformation. The flip-flop that you're referring to is the quote, "I voted for it, but then I voted against it."
Yeah.
What John Kerry actually meant by that, in a subcommittee in the Senate, he voted for
it. I understand that. That's not the only thing. He ran a terrible campaign. And, he's...
Anyway, look at the ministers of propaganda that we have running for the Bush company. We have people such as Rush Limbaugh. We have people like Bill O'Reilly, Hannity and Combs, Fox, The Foxhole. I'm sure you're a big
sure.
fan of them.
I've never watched them, but I know it's...
Peter Joseph Goebbels himself would be envious of this propaganda machine that's working for Bush.
Well, I agree. On the other hand, people have seemed to have figured it out by themselves. I mean, when we're talking about Foxhole News, they got an audience of like 1.5 million or something like that, trying to explain away Bush crimes. And if you watch ABC, NBC, CBS News, read Time Magazine, Newsweek, go on the Internet, all the information is there. I mean, the people that watch Foxhole News are in a polemic against reality. They won't face the facts. I mean, you'll never meet a Democrat that won't say, "No, I'm not entirely satisfied with the Democrats." Most people in the left of the Democratic Party will say, "God, they're tepid, they're terrible, they're never coherent, they have nothing but criticisms." But you got to remember, these Republicans on the right are these authoritarian personalities, and they will never criticize the leaders, the rulers, those above them on the hierarchical scale. So they're looking for information how they can twist reality enough so they can still hold their positions. What do they call it? Cognitive dissonance or something like that. So they get all that affirmation from you know, Rush and Sean and Foxhole News and what have you. And I think I think, did I just say this? Well, it was a couple of weeks ago when I was last on, that if you listen to right-wing radio, instead of listening to the blather that the hosts are putting across, listen to the callers. They're zeros. They never know anything. They bring, what they do is, I mean, it's a talk show, so once in a while they got to let some callers on. And these guys bring nothing to it. They say, you know, what do you think about what Hillary did? Or, aren't the Democrats going to blah, blah, blah? And essentially what they're doing is just setting up the host to carry on more. Whereas on any liberal show, the people that call in are really bright. I mean, generally. I would include you in the bright category. Maybe not everyone that still thinks that Al-Qaeda had anything to do with 9/11. I mean, that person ought to not take part in public opinions. All right. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. Call talkyes at yahoo.com is our phone number. And where are we here? We are going to make our show international and go to Ron in Ontario. Where are you calling from in Ontario, Ron?
Hey, Steve. I'm calling from Chatham, Kent,
hey, Bill.
Ontario.
Hey, just call me Peter for short, okay?
Okay, Pete.
Yeah.
Peter.
Yeah. And can, right. can you turn your radio completely off?
Oh, dude.
Dude.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Hey, I just wanted to say we got an election going on over here talking about democracy.
Yeah, sure.
And securities and borders. And I find it's very comforting to have security cameras everywhere. Bring it on, you know what I mean?
I'd like them in my house.
Well, you know, we do have nanny cams and all this kind of
sure, put them
technology.
Everywhere.
As far as Bushco and all this kind of stuff, you know, I'm in the auto parts industry,
mm-hmm.
and I know what shift work is. I'm a dread. I've got my dread card on my beer fridge, by the way.
Only a few people are going to know what that is. Hey, Ron, speaking of knowing, I was talking to somebody just today about Canadian politics and the election that's coming up, and I said, I'll bet you that 90% of people in Michigan do not know who the current prime minister is, and probably 90% don't know who the prime minister is, and probably 98% couldn't name at least four of the, what is it, five parties?
Well,
you got to remember, Reagan, when Brian Mulroney was prime minister, referred to him as President Muldoon.
Yeah, and that's such a long time ago. Right now, we've got Mr. Mahoney, what's his name?
and about 40% of Canadians don't know either. All right, Ron, we'll cut you loose, man. Thanks for making our show international. And, yes, let's have security cameras everywhere, including in our workplaces, in our houses, in the bathrooms, in the bedrooms, everywhere. And who the hell's going to watch all these? I don't know. Okay. All right. Brandon, I'm going to take this call from Boulder next, because it's Rich from Boulder, and don't want to keep him on hold too long. Rich, hi, it's Peter Werby. Welcome.
Hey, Pete, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was calling. I'd like to talk about liberal disconnect and personal responsibility. You've been talking about all these problems, and you know, anybody who's been on the internet for a few minutes kind of has a general idea of the things that are wrong, coming from politics to the environment to social structures and whatnot. And I find a lot of liberals, progressives, Democrats are very interested to talk about the problem, but not very interested in taking some personal responsibility and doing something about it. And I know it's really hard to do that a lot of times because of life constraints and obligations and whatnot, but it just seems, not to pick on you, Pete, but it's kind of a typical response when we talk about automobiles and our addiction to it. You know, there's the war in Iraq. There's, you know, the multiple deaths each year on the roads and whatnot.
Sure.
The perpetuation of corporate power. And, you know, Bush is doing what he does because we want to drive our cars and we want that freedom, so to speak.
Well,
there's an environmental crisis. I mean,
which is, yeah, there. I mean, people ought to look at what's going on. I mean, beginning with these wildfires that are sort of the canary in the coal mine.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of coal mine, well, I mean, I'm all for personal gestures, and the reason, I don't mean to sound like Cheney, who said something like that, but most efforts on the part of people whose concern for the environment is at a proper level that understands that we are poisoning the planet, that the Great Lakes is beginning, rather than clearing up like many of us thought, is in danger again, that global warming is slowing down the flow of warm water up to northern Europe and could create almost another ice age, that we may be almost to the point of no return, that the idea that China will become a modern industrial consumer nation and begin to have waste levels consistent with like ours, that will create a disaster of proportions that we may not be able to handle, ought to be understood on a social level. And if I decide, if I got rid of my car, if I didn't fly like the Venezuela and Cuba and California and New York like I do, and recycled everything possible and limited my consumption, some of which I do, that's not going to have much of an effect. What we need are social policies, and the first social policy we have to have is a realization of the crisis. I mean, I know you agree with that.
Sure, absolutely. But, you know, I mean, so it's all up to the government and our elected officials to take care of it?
No. They're idiots. I mean, they're the people that stood by and allowed it all to occur. Gestures can become real. If a lot of gestures coalesce into something material in a neighborhood, suddenly you're talking about a neighborhood movement. That then what you're doing isn't just sort of an oddity or people think, oh, that's the guy that recycles all the time or anything like that. And that can be transformed into something greater and greater. But it's all about social movements that have to begin with these gestures. So I'm not disagreeing with you. But, I mean,
yeah.
You think I could give up my car in Detroit?
Well, I think you could. You said you live a mile away from the station.
Yeah.
I think you could bike there.
I think
that is highly doable.
I know. You know, I'll tell you what. I mean, call me whatever, but I'm not biking home through part of the area I have to go through that actually surrounds this neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. I'll give you that.
Thank you. And also, you think I'm going to bike on a night like this?
Well, sure. I was out biking today when there was, you know, 60-mile gusts of wind, and I felt Mother Earth breathe on me, you know?
Yeah.
You don't feel that in a car.
No, you certainly don't.
And
but I hear you.
Well, in terms of gestures, my girlfriend and I, we just bought a townhome, and we moved here 3 months ago by bicycle. We invited folks to come help us out. We kind of built it as a Amish barn-raising kind of event.
Yeah.
And we brought a bunch of people together. We did a press release. The news came out and whatnot. So there was a gesture. And, you know, since then, people are coming up to us, oh, that's so cool, you know. And so we planted seeds with that gesture.
No, that's good. And some communities, and probably Boulder, probably Arcata, California, mm-hmm. they become models for what people could do.
Right.
Yeah, that it doesn't have to all be modern industrial that is beginning to, it's going to be the death of us all. Unless.
Yes.
All right, now, go ahead. Come on, Rich. We got to talk a little business now. Oh. You were giving me some good hints on my website.
Oh, yes.
And I actually took it. Did you see? I did.
Yeah.
I figured that out, but then you didn't write me back. Come on, man.
Oh, I did this afternoon.
Wait a minute. I'm looking. Did you write to, don't tell me if it was someone somewhere else, but did you write to
Call
Talk Yes? Mm-hmm. It's not on here. I'm looking at it right now.
I'll have to check my outbox then.
All right. Thank you, Rich.
We'll be in touch.
All right. Yes, do it. Boy, do I need... Yeah, it's funny. Some people say to me, hey, your website's so great. Most web designers, like Rich is from Boulder, California, they go, whoa. I mean, there's too much on there in some ways. But check it out. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. PeterWerbe.com. I'm not selling anything, so it's not why I urge you to go there. But if you think things like that one caller does, that somehow Al-Qaeda was connected with Iraq and responsible for 9/11, I mean, go there then. One of the things about tapping phones and communications. I mean, Bush got this information that an attack was imminent, and they ignored it. They were asleep at the switch. So the fact that they were able to do this interception didn't do a damn bit of good. Of course, nothing they've done from 9/11 to Katrina to the war has been effective. These are the people that some people say, well, they're going to protect our country. Whew.
Well, one thing they've done really well is make lots of money off oil profits.
Well, yeah, you're still with me, Rich. you're out of here. Thank you. Goodbye. Oh, man, I haven't done this in a while. All of a sudden, that shocked me. Here's somebody with a lot of patience, David in Detroit. David, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Yes, I'm calling about the plight of the American worker in the context of this week's huge announcement from IBM.
Right. Tell us. That's very important.
Well, it's a very profitable company. It's not in the dire straits of GM or Northwest Airlines, but it's planning to freeze its pension plan and eliminate the defined benefit retirement plan for all new incoming employees. And that marks a disturbing trend for the American worker. And if IBM starts that avalanche, you don't even know where it's going to end.
Sure you do. It's going to end exactly with less and less defined benefit pensions. What that means, if you're 19 years old, by the way, and listening, and you go, defined benefits, pensions, who cares? I don't know. You get to be 65 if you're lucky, at a fairly good clip. And just ask your dad or your grandparents or something like that. And what this means is that for the last, 75 years or so, that the company you work for and you were loyal to as an employee would put away a certain amount every month, and then when you retired, you wouldn't have to go to the poorhouse before Social Security like you had to, or you wouldn't have to depend just on Social Security because there would be money there in your pension. What they're doing now is you're going to be responsible for it. They may match it a little, but essentially you're going to take a pay cut because you're going to have to take a portion of your pay as opposed to them having another part of benefits where they invested in your pension. And they're doing this why? Because they can. It's the old thing, why does a dog... Oh, I can't say that, can I? Because they can. That's why. David, I mean, this is very important to bring up. It's not as sexy as war or the Constitution or anything like that. But these guys are going to send us all into third world status, or at least probably two-thirds of us.
Yes, and it means that we're all going to have to depend on our 401ks. And it's interesting that in 2006 they're starting this Roth 401k to kind of... It all coincides in the same timeline. And as well, there's another thing, which is that...
Wait a minute. Let me just say again. If you're 15 or 19 or something like that, and you don't know what the hell he's talking about, Roth 401ks or even what any of that is, they are talking about essentially your future and how you are going to be able to live, or maybe even your parents are going to be able to live, them in a few years, you in quite a few decades. But... this is part of this system of looting that is accelerating, that these corporations are accelerating, again, because they can, because there's no organized resistance. For years, unions were in the forefront of this. But because of social policy, because of a lot of the unions got pretty staid, that's not an option anymore. And so it's really going to be thrown back on us. And if we don't do anything, we're going to really be screwed badly. Those of you who aren't screwed already, and that's probably a good number of you, are going to wind up to be screwed. You say, well, I'm going to be in that one-third. I'm not going to be the peasants. I'm not going to be the ones that are going to have to thatch my roof and doff my cap as our betters go by. You hope. All right, we'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com. Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919.
Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. I told you it was going to be quick, and that's the way it usually is around this time of the year. All right, we talked, let me see if I still have this here, about how much, when's this from? July 17th, 2005, from sfgate.com, SF, like in frankgate.com. The cost of the Iraq war could cost as anywhere from $0.75 trillion to $1.5 trillion, according to this article. And of course, talking about getting screwed, that screws any ability we have, for instance, to have a national health program or to have communities like we deserve and have the wealth for. So it all just goes down this rat hole of Bushco corporations that made the war, that continue to make the war, that profit off the war from destruction and, of course, from rebuilding it as well. Now, how about this? The real cost, where's this from here? This is from The Guardian in the UK. The real cost to the U.S. of the war in Iraq is likely between $1 trillion and $2 trillion, up to 10 times more than previously thought, according to a report written by a Nobel Prize-winning economist and a Harvard budget expert. The study, which expanded, the report came during one of the most deadly periods in Iraq since the invasion. 11 U.S. troops killed. This is before the 12 today and the 5 that were killed in fighting. And the paper on the real cost of the war, written by Joseph Stiglitz, a Columbia University professor who won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2001, is likely to add to the pressure on the White House on the war. I mean, they're impervious to it. Stiglitz told The Guardian, "Our estimates are very conservative, and it could be that the final cost will be much higher. And it should be noted that they do not include the cost of the conflict to either Iraq or the UK." So, this is where, and when they say the U.S., this is you and me. This is Detroit. This is your neighborhood. This is the state of Michigan. This is the entire country. All of this racket is funded by us, by you and me. And it's not going into stuff for us. It's going down this rat hole that only the richies are able to afford. Now, I don't remember whether, I mean, this was a while ago, so I don't remember whether or not I mentioned this. But David Brooks, who's the CEO of DHB Industries, threw this lavish party in Manhattan on November 26th. Now, here was the lineup of entertainment. Now, these big aid concerts where they get the greatest people together. This is for a bat mitzvah, which is like a bar mitzvah that Jewish kids have when they're 13. The boys have bars, the girls have bats. Here's who performed at this bat mitzvah for the CEO of DHB Industries. Aerosmith. What? Did he say that the Aerosmith played at a private party? Yeah. Aerosmith played for the bat mitzvah of David H. Brooks' daughter. And so did 50 Cent. And so did Kenny G. And so did Tom Petty. Now, here's where this guy got all this money. His company saw its stock price soar after it won a military contract for bulletproof vests. After Brooks sold stock worth $186 million, the Marine Corps received 5,200 vests recalled over 5,000 vests because of concerns about their effectiveness. So here is a man that sucked tens of millions of dollars out of the common wealth that we produce and provide for this country, used it to make vests to protect our soldiers that weren't even adequate to do that. As it turns out, and I don't know if they're exactly this guy's vest, but that casualties could have been reduced in some cases as much as 80% if these vests that they sent over there would have been properly designed. So, let me see, who else? I thought there were some other people there. Don Henley showed up, Joe Walsh, and they performed with Fleetwood Mac's Stevie Nicks, rap diva Sierra, who I don't even know who that is. And the women on the way out of this party for this 13-year-old kid got $1,000 Vuitton bags, complete with digital cameras and the latest video iPod. So, while our communities are suffering because we can't make our budgets for our schools, where the Chicago has to raise its bus fare that because they're working at a deficit, these war profiteers are making tens of millions of dollars. And this guy's probably penty ante. He's just a little obnoxious. Although I don't know the number of homes, for instance, between the Vice, Cheney, and Rumsfeld is pretty obscene as well. So they get rich, and the working class and the poor die. Support our oops, right? Peter Werby with you here on Night Call, 313-298-WRIF. And let's go to our phones. Okay, here is Will. Will's in Windsor. Will, thanks for joining us and making our program international. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Boy, there's a thousand issues that I'd like to discuss, but I guess I wanted to make one point. You were talking earlier about the torture policies of the Bush administration, and I just want to make a comment about one particular case that's having a fairly profound effect on the Canadian elections here.
Sure, I know the one, but go ahead, tell our listeners.
Oh, about the Moses Arar. He's a 19-year-old Canadian citizen, originally from Syria, who was on holidays with his family, and in 2002 was making a plane change in New York City at Kennedy Airport, and the CIA arrested him, flew him in a private jet to Syria, where he was put into a cage, like an underground cage, and for 2.5 years, and he was tortured repeatedly to make confessions of it. What happened was this, is that they had just, his last name was mistaken for someone they were looking for, someone who had ties to presumably to Al-Qaeda or some Arab terrorist group. He had nothing to do with it. He was totally innocent. And of course, he was proclaiming his innocence for all this time, but nobody was listening. But after 2.5 years and after torturing and putting, with the old, testicles and the electrodes and a significant amount of psychological torture and food and sleep deprivation, the Syrians finally came to the conclusion that he was innocent, and they shipped him back to Canada here, and it became a big scandal here in this country. And he tried to sue the United States or try and get some sort of compensation from the United States government, and of course the Bush administration just dismissed him and ignored it. And so this caused a lot of problems here in Canada, and now the Liberal Party, which is now basically on the ropes, the federal government, which is now, or federal party, now in power, and they're starting to bring these issues up and playing the American card, because their opponent, Stephen Harper of the Conservatives, is a big Bush supporter, a very right-wing ideologue out of the rich oil.
Well, he's not going to get anywhere with that. I mean, overwhelmingly, don't like 80% of the Canadian people in polls think that Bush is awful?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in Canada, he has personally no support. And the thing is, I don't want the Americans, we want the Americans to understand, because I listen to Bill O'Reilly and these guys, they think that, and they denigrate Canadians, saying that we hate Americans. It's not that. We're long-term allies, but we do hate the Bush administration, and we don't like that it scares us the way we
think it's going. Well, as I'm sure you know, is that Bush is probably the single most unpopular president around the world since one of these last Republicans or Reagan. Did you hear me earlier saying that when Brian Mulroney was the prime minister, that he referred to him as President Muldoon?
Yeah.
And yep. What do you think about what I said here? You're just a stone's throw away from us across the river. How many Americans do you think know who is the current Canadian prime minister?
Well, not many. We have a fun show up here, the CBC does. It says, Let's Talk to Americans. And we have one of our comedians go down. He interviews Americans and asks them questions about Canada. Like,
Rockefeller?
What do you think about Prime Minister Poontang and things like that? And he gets all these obscure answers.
I've actually heard about that.
Yeah, it's kind of, there's a joke up here, you know, that Americans know their American history, but they're historically and geographically challenged.
Okay, thank you, Will. I got to move on. I appreciate your call at 313-298-298. WRIF, Sam from Macomb, welcome to the broadcast. I don't mean to embarrass you because you're probably in vast majority. Do you know who the Prime Minister of Canada is? No, okay. Wait, what's that terrible noise? Hey, Sam, what's... Okay, just went away. Go ahead. Oh, here it comes again. Can you hear that crackling?
Yeah, I hear that.
Are you on a cell phone?
Yeah.
Can you, let me do this. Let me put you on hold, and you find something that's a little more, move somewhere, and we'll try it again. Because that is terrible, man. Just absolutely terrible. Here is, Robert in Redford. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Peter. I've been listening to you for a while now, and I've got to tell you, you're right on with a lot of your facts and a lot of everything you're saying about the Bush administration. The first thing I'd like to point out is, I don't know whether a lot of people are aware of it. I've talked about it to a couple of people. It's something I read in the Free Press right after Bush in office. I wish I could find that paper.
Yeah.
Again, because right there when he was talking about his administration, one of the first things he put out in the front of his administration was to remove Saddam Hussein from office. And it was stated in the Free Press, and I wish I could find that issue again. Another thing is, they keep coming back with all these people from Iraq saying how much they want us there. And one of the main reasons they want us there is because Iran is on the border waiting for us to get out of there.
Well, they don't even necessarily have to do that. The Shiites, the ones that won, that are bound and determined to make it a Islamic Republic, they're allies with the Iranians. And the Iranians congratulated the Iraqis after the election, telling them they are on the way to a Islamic Republic.
Right. I mean, we really have no business over there, never had any real business over there. I can understand the Afghanistan, I can understand a few other things, but Bush is creating a dictatorship, which people fail to see.
Well, this will be, once again, our dictatorship, because that's what Saddam Hussein was. Saddam Hussein's government in the 1980s was taken off the list of terrorist countries. So Reagan and Bush 1, could sell all this necessary equipment that Saddam could use for his war against Iran. I mean, it was sort of the way that Chamberlain and Roosevelt and others before World War One were hoping that Hitler would only attack the Soviet Union. And they were all for that. Same way, they were very pleased that Iraq and Iran were fighting. It's all very, very, very cynical. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see if we can go back to Sam and see if he's solved his... Sam, you're still crackling. Did you move?
No, I'm trying to think so.
Well, God, I can't do it then, man. We got to say goodbye because that sounds absolutely terrible. Here's Daryl in Clinton Township. Hey, Daryl, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing, sir?
Doing great. Thanks.
I hope you don't mind if I change the subject a little bit. By the way, I enjoyed the interviews this morning on the other station.
Shh.
I really enjoyed them.
Shh.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. But those same interviews are going to play at 1 a.m. tonight.
Yeah, I listen to them all the time.
Great.
At my job when I'm working midnights and Saturday nights. But it kind of brings me to my point. I wanted to talk to you about radio as a whole and as a business and what people like Ted Stevens are trying to do to cable and regulating satellite, regulating regular radio even harder.
Yeah.
And it just really upsets me. I'm actually a satellite subscriber as well. I have like three stations I still listen to like crazy on the FM and AM dial. And I think it's great that we have all these different mediums, and I'm kind of disappointed that, like a lot of regular radio stations, I mean, even the Riff puts on, for Drew and Mike, no subscription needed. But, I mean, I'm amazed at, like, the wonderful, amounts of freedom. It's not about the F word, and it's not about being dirty. I think it's more about just the freedom to say and talk like adults and not be regulated and listened to by the government. They have no right telling us in my opinion, unless you're being absolutely ridiculous and filthy. I look at like people like Lenny Bruce and how he was persecuted for being on a stage and saying things that were against the the establishment religion and things of that nature. And I'm kind of just bummed that, you know, even regular radio is coming out against, you know, other competitive.
It's about competition, and I don't want to go on. I don't think my bosses would appreciate even a phone call. I mean, so here's some censorship going, what I rarely do. But, I mean, there's certain boundaries that, I can say anything politically I want. But, I don't want to disparage advertisers. I'm certainly not going to promote other forms of, I'm going to say, hey, in the morning, why don't you watch whatever those morning television shows are? I mean, there's an enormous investment in this industry and in particular stations like this one. And so I'm not going to encourage anybody to watch a program on, say, when Drew and Mike are on in the morning. And if that seems compromised, so be it. But at work, we often have to be, there's little compromises that have to be made. But there was something that you say, oh, yeah, Bush. And what Bush has done is not only to put, is involved in this absolute cronyism again. He has filled a position with on the FCC, an interim appointment. What he does is when his appointments get challenged because either the people are incompetent or there's nepotism, which means you're putting into place somebody's relative, which has happened time and time again. The Senate now is saying, hey, what do you, you can't do this. We want to know why you're putting in the former chief of staff's niece into one of these positions, and why this guy who has done these awful things is up for appointment. So Bush now just waits till Congress is gone. This is more my favorite form of government is a dictatorship, as he said four times. And they circumvent the process of advice and consent. That's what it says in the Constitution. So I didn't even mention that. I forgot that. I was talking earlier the incredible, egregious, continual violations of the Constitution by Bush Co. There's another one. They're violating that aspect, not of the Bill of Rights, like we were talking earlier, but of the Constitution itself. All right. Well, thank you for listening, Daryl. I appreciate it. And we shall talk. There's some open lines, by the way, if you'd like to grab one. And that is 313-298-WRIF. Now's the chance to sound off. Here's Greg. Greg is in Ortonville. Hey, Greg, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. My name is Greg. I'm a Gulf War veteran from the first Gulf War. And I have a few issues. I don't know. I listen to your show when I'm on my home from work on Sunday nights. I'm sorry. And I get a little worked up about certain things. As far as the first Gulf War goes, what Bush Sr. did is an atrocity in itself to our soldiers that were over there. He's turned his back on us. And then to see what we're doing over here and our boys dying every single day, it's ridiculous. We shouldn't be there in the first place. It was all a huge lie. We all know that. But as far as helping the people of that country go, that when you take the oath in the service, when you take an oath, that's part of the oath is to help the oppressed. And I believe that we have a good intent. The soldiers over there deserve and need our support, first off. And secondly,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Greg, but how do you support them? I mean, the way I support them, I say, is stop the fighting.
Bring them home. I don't want to see another Vietnam with these boys.
Well, of course not.
They come home and people, I hear people talk about it. They're over there and they hear all these atrocities and, and spin by the press. They're spin by the press. When I was over there 13 years ago, they were spin by the press. And it was sad. What we went through, what people went through and who was left behind and It just bothers me. It hurts my soul, to be honest with you.
Well, it should, too.
The next thing I have to say is we all talk about what Bush is doing with this and that and the FCC and how he's screwing up radio and censorship and everything. But you know what? He's going to do what he wants because what are we going to do to him? He's out in 4 years. He's going to be on the book tour circuit. So what good is it going to, am I wrong?
I hadn't thought of that. Right.
But he's going to be on the book tour circuit. It's like, when
Clinton.
I'm not a... I'm not a Democrat or Republican. I vote for who I think is the best candidate. And it's just like when Clinton was second term in office, forgave everybody from the Whitewater scandal.
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to do? There's nothing we can do about it now. It's just like here in Detroit, reelecting Kwame. You know, what the heck are people thinking? What are we going to do now, though? He's here for 4 years. The other guy, you know, Bush is here for 4 years. There's nothing we can do about it. What we need to do is more people, you know, it's like they say with the gas shortage and everything, all the gas this and the gas that. We have a huge stock supply of gas.
Sure, the shortage is engineered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To get money from the poor, from the poor working people of this state and this country.
Hey, Greg, let me interrupt you on one thing. You may be interested in this. You know, the Military Times, which mostly has you know, people that are in long-term service, and Bush's support among those people in the U.S. Armed Forces is just 54%. I mean, he's heading down below 50% with the military.
What? Here's the thing. When you're in the military, you dare not say anything against the commander-in-chief. You can vote against him. You don't have to vote for him. You know, you have to see down. But you do not... It'd be like talking about the base commander. And, you know, those guys, like when I was in the service, that were drummed out of the service. For instance, just an instance, I'm not going to say names or anything, but there was a captain and a private first class. They were in a homosexual relationship. Now, the private first class got a dishonorable discharge and lost everything. The officer was retired with full benefits.
Yeah, wow. So, let me tell you.
You know what I mean? That's just what I say. It's,
you know, that's
bad about the big guy.
That's interesting. A friend of mine who's a Gulf War vet, he got hit on by his base commander, and you know, who was a man, and my friend's a man, and he said, "Well, you know, base commander doesn't." You know, he says, "You know, that's really not my sexual preference, but you know, whatever." And the guy, so the commander says, "Well, we're going to forget about this incident, aren't we?" And he said, "Sure." And he said, "Anytime you need leave, anytime you need any problems, just get a hold of me." So, all right, thanks a lot, Greg. I know you got a lot more to say, but I have got to move on. Thank you so much. Peter Werbe here with you on Night Call, 313-298-WRIF. Roy is listening in Placitas, New Mexico. And let's see, he says, "It's not what they know that bothers me. It's not what they don't know that worries me. It's what they know that ain't so that scares the hell out of me." Probably not the direct Mark Twain quote. Well, that makes, that's interesting. But thank you for that. Let's see, here's Keith in Livonia. Keith, hi, it's Peter Werbe, and you're on the air.
Yes, indeed. Well, I should say, Peter, this is Keith indeed. It's been too many years, too much water under the bridge. Good to talk to you again.
Well, I think I can say that recognizing your voice, that your brother will be a guest at 1 a.m. talking about nuclear power.
Well, bless your heart.
Yes.
And bless his heart. And I trust he'll do a good job.
Oh, it's fabulous.
I mean, there have been so many years, and yet here we find ourselves talking about a lot of the same issues.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Spent fuel on site, you know, no permanent disposal available. Even more than that, you know, the Federal Bureau of Investigation is investigating the U.S. Geological Survey for falsifying water flow data at Yucca Mountain.
That's where they say they're going to put all the nuclear waste that has to be secure for 200,000 years.
Yeah. And having been part of this debate for 25 years now, I can tell you that no matter what side of the debate you come down on, whether you're pro-nuclear or anti-nuclear, both sides, at least for a long time, agreed that you have to have two things to have successful isolation of nuclear waste from the environment. One is geologic stability, and two is a lack of water. And Yucca Mountain in Nevada flunks both.
So now we've got all this nuclear waste just piling up, like down at Fermi 2. But, Keith, you are stealing your brother's thunder.
Stop that.
Well, how about this instead, because I don't have this up on my website yet.
Okay.
Give the information about this concert with Charlie King and his partner.
Okay. Charlie King and Karen Brandow are doing a benefit concert for Peace Action of Michigan, which is a group I co-chair here in lovely Ferndale, Michigan. And that is next Saturday night at 8 o'clock at Birmingham Unitarian Church. in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, Woodward and Lone Pine Road. For more information, folks can call area code 248-548-3920. And they are fabulous political
activists. Yeah, they are. They're great. And I will put that on my website, calendar. I just, this is, wait a minute.
By the way, I'm ashamed to say, today was the first day I've ever looked at your website, and I've got to tell you, it is wonderful.
How about we do this? I'm actually interested. I can't remember the last time I put two people on together, but here's somebody from Monroe. And
oh, my goodness.
So we can all three of us can talk.
Oh,
but
this
let me,
could be a lot of fun.
But before I get Ken on, I'll get you on in a second, Ken. I spoke down in Monroe, 5-6 years ago, and they sort of had me like as a WRIF DJ. So I said, it's a pleasure to be here in Monroe, the home of General George Custer and Fermi II, and I crossed my fingers in the good luck sign. And it was weird about, half the people laughed and half the people booed. But let's get Ken on. Ken, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're also on with Keith. And what did you have to say about Yucca Mountain?
Hey, Keith.
Hey, Ken.
I just wanted to let you know that what you're saying is totally correct when we're talking about it's going to take how many thousands of years for this stuff to be. I think what really needs to be what we need to concentrate on at this point, we know time, distance, and shielding is one of the biggest. They're the three biggest issues when it comes to nuclear safety. Not a whole lot of people know that.
Well, when you talk about distance, you ain't very far from it all, and neither are we here in Detroit.
And you don't have to tell me about that. I've been trying to get the community emergency response team training available in Monroe County for, 5-6 years now. It's a free program that FEMA offers.
FEMA?
Post I hear
you.
They've got it covered, Peter. Okay? FEMA's got it covered.
Doing a heck of a job, Brownie.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
Information is key.
Yeah.
To put the mindset on the table that there ain't no help coming, that's what you need to know. That is what you need to have as a mindset. You need to be able to call on your own resources.
Well, I hope we don't ever get to the point where we have to, and that's the whole deal, to head all this off. And Keith's brother, Paul Gunter, on this interview that's coming up, I hope you can stay up and listen to it, talks about what we should do. And first and foremost, if you have a leak and you want to do some plumbing, first thing you do is you shut off the water. All right, Ken, I got to move on from both you guys. So thank you, Ken. And also, Keith, thank you as well. And stay tuned about 35 minutes for your bro. I don't have this up. Okay.
Go on.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. Let me see. I'm not hitting the right buttons here. All right, there we go. Okay, some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. And here's Ned. Ned's in Northville. Hi, Ned. It's Peter Werby.
Hey, Peter. I've been listening to your show for a little while, and I think you hit on some great subjects. I'm just wondering if the show is purely entertainment and to educate the public, or does it actually produce any change in the government or any of the other subjects that you touch on?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, in some ways you'd be a better judge of that than me. I mean, one of the things that I'm here to do is to provide WRIF what's called public service programming. And so we talk about the issues of the day, and that cools us with the FCC. I mean, the show is also very popular, so the management is happy about that. But I don't know. It's kind of hard to say, is it ABC? I mean, some people say, they have rallies, or they vote, or they go to demonstrations, and does that change anything? On one hand, you could almost make the argument that nothing does anything change. The same crooks are in power, screwing the same people for their benefit. And you might say, why even bother? Let's go fishing.
Right.
Well,
hey, I really appreciate the show, and I think it's excellent, and I've learned a lot, and I'll just continue to listen.
Well, I appreciate it, Ned. Thank you very much.
All right, have a good one.
All right, have a good one. And, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people opt out of political activity and kind of hope for social change because it looks near to impossible, is that old saying, you can't fight City Hall. And yet, Howard Zinn, Z-I-N-N, hear me say this from time to time. If you haven't read Howard Zinn, you're missing a whole, what would you say, perspective on American history. Howard Zinn, he has a book called People's History of the United States. People's History of the United States. It's the best-selling history book in American history. It sold over a million copies. And he said that we being the people that want to create decent change and always have since the inception of this country, we lose every battle but the last one. So when this country started, it was a slave state, right? Slave nation where only white men with property could vote. That was it. And there's still tons of problems. Some of them seem almost insurmountable. The people that have control and benefit, the people that benefit, pardon me, out of so bad everything is, they seem to be so insulated from popular control that they control wealth, they control the armaments, they control the propaganda machine. And so how can little old you or little old me do anything? Well, that's what people just took it upon themselves in the 1820s and 1830s and said, we have to end slavery. And a bunch of feisty women, 1870s, 1880s, said, why? What do you mean women can't vote? What is that all about? What about all the people that said we want to form unions in the 1930s? People that wanted to end a war or have, in the usual concept, have everyone have the same rights in the 1950s and 1960s. These often were people just like you and just like me that felt powerless, that looked at the edifice of power and wealth aligned against them. And it said, we will crush you if you mess with our power or money. If you try to change anything, we will crush you. And you know what? They often crushed individuals. They ruined lives. They framed people up. They murdered people. And I'm talking about the abolitionists. No, women didn't get it that bad. The people that opposed World War I. Remember my little, if you're new to this program, why did we enter World War I? Big blank, right? People that opposed that war, on and on and on throughout American history. But that's what they always said. We will crush you. And enough people that are decent people, that want fairness and justice and liberty for all, and we're crushed. We're killed. And are the martyrs to fairness and justice. And many of you may say, well, I don't know if I want to be a martyr to justice. Well, I'm not saying that everybody that speaks up is going to get whacked, but the more you challenge their power, the meaner they get. But if there's enough of us, there's an old, I can't remember what the Doors song. This you can't email me about, the Doors song that they say, well, they got the guns, but we got the numbers. And we got to use the numbers. Here are these auto suppliers and auto companies just screwing their workers big time. And there was a demonstration today down at Cobo Hall where the opening of the International Auto Show. And about 500 workers showed up. People go, whoa, that's a lot of people. That was a pretty feisty demonstration. I didn't get down to it. I should. I'm a union member, a broadcasters union. But the thing is, all of us should have been down there. Because what these people are doing in protecting their wage and their standard of living is protecting all of our wages and standard of living. And if we allow them to get screwed, or if they allow themselves to get screwed, like, it's not clear why they didn't have 5,000 of their own people down there. But people feel that demoralized, that powerless. And this is a democracy. People are supposed to feel empowered. But the nature of the machine is such that it works to tell us, you can't do anything, and if you try, we'll crush you. Well, who do we admire most in American history? All right, we'll be right back. I think it's just like 60 seconds or so.
This is WRIF.com.
The lowdown on the hottest concerts in town are only a click away with a singular wireless concert connection. Log on to the concerts page right now at WRIF.com to find out where your favorite bands are appearing live in concert across the Motor City. Keep it right here on the Riff for your chance to text in to win tickets, backstage passes, autographed rock merchandise, and more exclusively on your singular wireless phone. The singular wireless concert connection from Singular Wireless, raising the bar at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix, the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend at University of Phoenix.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Remember to stay tuned at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, and we'll have some great interviews for you, including this first one. I got to figure out, looking at something, it's all code. How the hell am I supposed to figure out which is which? All right, that's my problem, not yours. The United States has intervened, particularly during the first 50 years or so of the 20th century, so from 1900 to 1950, something like 100 times in other countries around the world, mostly in Latin and South America, and almost exclusively to protect the interest of corporate investments and banks and what have you. And when the people of those countries tried to, like, overthrow a dictator, because the United States sponsored all these dictators and torture states, and in that period, the United States would rush in and stop the people from doing that. And Julie from Ann Arbor sent this in, and I think I'll put it on my website. This is a quick political scholastic aptitude test. This test consists of one multiple-choice question. Here's a list of countries the U.S. has bombed since the end of World War II. China, Korea, China again, Guatemala, Indonesia, Cuba, Guatemala, Congo, Peru. This is just through, like, the mid-60s. Laos, Vietnam for 12 years, Cambodia, Guatemala, 67 to 69, Grenada, Libya, 86, El Salvador, Nicaragua during the 1980s, Panama, 1989, Iraq, 1991 to 2002, Sudan, 1998, thank you, Bill Clinton, Afghanistan in 1998, Clinton did that, Yugoslavia in 1999, Afghanistan in 2001, and Iraq in 2003. So the question is, in how many of these instances did a democratic government respectful of human rights occur as a direct result? And let's do this. We'll ask somebody. Hi, you're on the air. It's Peter Werby. It's Night Call on WRIF. I don't see a name up there. Who's this?
This is Amanda.
Amanda, do you know the answer? How many of those countries I just named wound up to be a democratic government respectful of human rights?
I actually have no idea. I wanted to ask you, you said something about impeachment.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask, what was the website that you mentioned?
Impeach.org. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. ImpeachPAC, P-A-C, ImpeachPAC.org.
Okay. And what, sorry to change the subject.
That's okay.
What are the chances that you think something could actually happen? Do you think the president actually could end up getting impeached?
It all depends on what happens next November. If there is, first off, increasing evidence of criminality on the part of the Bush administration in violation of the Constitution, which meets the constitutional criteria for impeachable offenses, they're there already. And John Conyers of Detroit, who introduced a resolution to censure Bush and Cheney for refusal to cooperate with House investigations, it was the one who introduced the resolution to impeach Richard Nixon. So there's a good history here. Also, Amanda, were you writing down? Do you have a pen?
Yes, I do.
All right. I don't know if you caught the spelling of my last name, but my first name is Peter, and my last name is Werby, which is W-E-R-B as in boy E. So it's PeterWerby.com. And if you go there, there's a link almost immediately to all the impeachment sites.
Okay, thank you. And I was also wondering, I'm a big fan of the 60s, and I was wondering, you know, how can we kind of apply what they did in the 60s here today, like protesting? What kind of things could I do?
Well, I mean, protests are one. Where do you live? Where'd you say?
I live in between Detroit and Lansing, kind of close to the Capitol, so I could always, you know, go there.
Sure. Well, there's all sorts of peace and social justice groups, and ones that are in, come out of churches, others that are, you know, if you got to really start searching. Like if you put in peace groups, Lansing, or impeach Bush, Lansing. Something like that in Google. You'll find it. They're out there.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Let's see. Here is Mike. Mike is calling from Windsor. Hey, Mike, who is the Prime Minister of Canada?
Paul Martin. Yeah. Hi, Peter. I've listened to your show for a while.
Yeah, I know. I knew you knew. How many Americans do you think know who is?
None that I know, but I'd probably say maybe about 15-20%.
Yeah, well, I think...
In Michigan.
I think
in Georgia, none.
But. Yeah, I think you're probably wrong. And then if they had to name the parties... You know what? I can't. Let's see here. I'm shooting myself. There's the Liberal, the Conservatives, the New Democratic Party, the Parti Québécois, and what's the right wing party, the sort of the new one from the West?
The Green Party.
They actually call it the Green Party? No.
Yeah. It's they're like naturalists, and they want to legalize marijuana, and they got a seat in BC. British Columbia, because that's where they pretty much grow everything here.
Okay, good. What's on your mind? You said you wanted to talk about toxic waste?
Yeah, the toxic waste. I work at a customs brokerage.
Oh, my God.
And I see a lot of stuff going to and from the States. And one of the things that I like is Toronto sells garbage to the United States.
Right.
And another thing that we also sell is just human waste. And you guys are worried about the toxic waste, which I understand completely, but I just don't understand why you would want to buy garbage.
Well, wait a minute. We don't buy garbage.
Yes.
You sell us garbage.
Yeah.
Well, there's a difference. We're not buying the garbage from Toronto. Toronto is paying us.
No, Toronto sells it to be burnt for fuel.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
In that mass burn incinerator, that monstrosity down at the where I-94 and and I-75 intersect. I thought that they were paying. You sure about this?
Yeah, because we would just drop it in a landfill. There's plenty of area in Canada we got.
Yeah,
but we actually sell it to the United States.
Well. That's one of the things that the critics of this mass burn incinerator that they put in the middle of Detroit, in their wisdom, that's it. You know who owns the Detroit incinerator now?
No, I don't.
You're not going to believe it. The okay. Philip Morris Company. This is true. Anyway, and it's turned out to be the economic disaster that the critics of it claimed. It's the environmental disaster, and it is illegal to recycle in Detroit. Now, I don't mean to say that if you take bottles somewhere, they're going to, you know, cops are going to arrest you. But the burn, in order to create, waste to energy burner. So the burn garbage. And this was going to be the idea. We get rid of all our trash and we get all of, you know, get energy back for it. So they need as much. So there's no recycling program whatsoever other than private concerns in Detroit. And it's some little ordinance that doesn't allow it, although they don't stop people that do. So it's an absolute monstrosity, and the more the arrogance and stupidity of the people in power.
Yeah. There's another point I had, too. I believe you asked why the United States got involved in World War One.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that was the sinking of the Lusitania.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was one of them. There was something called the Zimmerman Note, and it turned out, and we were horrified. What was wrong with the sinking of the Lusitania?
It was a cruise ship.
Yeah, and it was what they called unrestricted submarine warfare. Of course, it turns out that the Lusitania was, just as the Germans said, laden with munitions going to Britain in violation of the U.S. Neutrality Act at the time. So the U.S. and the British actually set up the Lusitania. So how many of all those countries that the U.S. bombed, how many resulted in a democratic government respectful of human rights?
Oh, none.
Yeah, actually, here's the choices. Zero, actually, you got to see it. So it's zero, none, not a one, or a whole number between minus one and plus one, which is zero.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Appreciate your call. A lot of calls from Windsor. All right, Brandon, you want me to choose my own? We haven't talked about this that much. It's Nick from Ypsilanti wants to talk about the Abramoff scandal. And let me just say before you start, if you don't know what we're talking about, go online and find out. All right, go ahead, Nick. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I'm a truth seeker, a contemporary of yours, and that's all I'm going to say about that because
okay. I'll
have context later.
I got you.
But the Abramoff scandal is one that's been strangely absent from the mainstream media, in case you maybe haven't noticed. Yet, this is why I mentioned this earlier, your contemporary has been all over this like white on rice. What's your take on this?
Well, I don't know. They've been the mainstream media has been pretty good about this scandal and how what it's touching. But as you say this, I'm looking through Yahoo News, and you're right. There's not an absolute. There's absolutely not one mention.
You know what I've heard of so much that I'm about to the point where I just want to start screaming and breaking things. Miners.
Yeah.
And okay, it was horrible. All right, move on. The miners. Scott Peterson is back in the news. Scott Peterson. God, who cares?
I know.
And, some others, I can't bring them to mind right now, but, that baby Noor or whatever. Okay, look, you know, these are very nice. Who cares?
Yeah.
The Abramoff scandal? Nothing. Nothing.
Well, I wouldn't say nothing. I mean, it's been on the front page of the major papers, like the Washington Post, the New York and Los Angeles Times, and Newsweek and Time. So it's not like it's not there. And this Jack Abramoff scandal is, I think, has the potential, as it should, to bring down Bush Co. and this criminal government, because they're all tied into it. It's solely a 100% Republican scandal. Government was for sale. These people were so arrogant that they fed at this trough of this corrupt lobbyist and made no bones about it. Now we have the White House scurrying around trying to find out how many times was Abramoff in the White House, how many photographs did he appear in with Bush. This, they can sweep it under the rug for a while, and they like these stories about of human tragedy. They don't mention too much that the human tragedy probably could have been avoided if Bushko hadn't cut mine enforcement funds and hadn't put in a lobbyist for the mine industry head of mine safety in 2001. But that's the way it goes. We'll look for it. Thank you, Nick. I appreciate it. And let's see here. Oh, yeah. Let's see if we can find some more information about this. It's Todd in Detroit. Todd, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Doing excellent.
The caller earlier about the Toronto garbage. That garbage is not going to it doesn't go to that incinerator that's downtown.
This is the stuff that's landfilled, right?
Right. That Toronto garbage goes directly to the landfills, and he is right. It is turned into a fuel, but it's turned into methane.
Okay.
It runs generators and is sold back to the power companies as electricity.
So in the meantime, though, they're taking this horrible stuff through the border. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's not as horrible as everybody thinks. The Michigan State did a study. They had surveyors out here, and they checked through all the garbage as it was being dumped, and they found that the American garbage has actually got more banned material in it.
Really?
Than the Toronto garbage. Theirs is recycled more than ours is.
Well, I was thinking not just stuff, bad stuff, but just kind of garbage isn't real fun.
Well, no, garbage isn't real fun, but, you know.
Don't tell me you truck it.
No, I don't.
Okay. Because we've had people that truck it on the air before. All right. Well, thank you for the information. I appreciate that, Todd. Thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Some lines have opened up again. And as things close down in this country and people work more and more for less and less as the rich get richer and the middle class and the working class get poorer, Spain, famous for its long work days and long lunches, is closing its government offices earlier and giving civil servants flex time so they can spend more time with friends and family. So a lot of these countries in Europe are trying to figure out how they can give people more time off. I mean, do you know that the Americans, we have less time off than any other workforce in the industrial world? How come that is? Yeah, because they can do it to us, right? Maybe next week we should examine the number one theory. Remember that? USA, number one. What social good is the U.S. number one in? If there's one, I mean health, all this stuff like this, I don't know about it. And we should, maybe I'll talk about it next week. I don't want to give it away for this one. All right, here is, let's see, Jennifer is calling from hell.
Hello?
This is Hell, Michigan, not from hell, right?
Yeah, Hell, Michigan.
I've been there.
You have? You really?
I have. I've been to the damn site in. Is that still ongoing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That and Scream's Ice Cream Parlor. Yeah. I live on the lake right behind there.
It's so nice. Right near the Pinckney Recreation Area, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anytime I want to go walking around in there, all I have to do is cut through the backyard.
You know, I used to do a lot of like big time bicycle riding, you know, big like 100 miles at a time and all that. And for one time, it was not so far away, but we used to have a ride that we would ride to, from Ann Arbor to Hell. So we used to call it to Hell and Back.
Yeah, they do a run through Hell too.
Yeah, and then did this ever happen? I wanted to have a bike ride that went from Hell to Bliss. With Bliss is a town, you know, I mean, that's quite, it's about, I don't know, 140, 150 miles away. Anyways, that's not
what I'm not sure.
Okay, what did you, what's up, Jennifer?
Well, what I was going to say is, you know how you were talking about earlier how in like the 1920s and the 1950s and stuff, people used to, you know, try to get social change done.
Right.
I mean, from personal experience, I think especially with the classes getting farther and farther apart, people are just not caring as much about each other as they used to. Like, you know, you used to be able to have your whole neighborhood out and about and know everybody in the neighborhood. Now it's like, you know, it's ridiculous how much people hurt people.
Or
nowadays,
we just stay at home and watch TV.
Exactly. And we watch these shows where people hurt people. Like, I mean, I'm not saying I don't watch them too, because I'm guilty of that, you know, Law and Order and stuff. Then all these reality TV shows where people are just hurting each other, you know, that show Cheaters that's on at night. And I mean, it's just, we're just watching continually, sitting at home, watching other people's pain. And I think people are just not caring about each other. I mean, look at the divorce rates, look at suicide rates, everything. Those are like skyrocketing.
Well, you know,
and this is from when I was a kid, and I'm only 23. You know.
Well, you know, Jennifer, there are a lot of options. For one thing, I've never seen Law and Order. I've never seen Cheaters. I've never seen Survivor, whatever the hell they are. Never seen what's the thing where the you know, the talent contest or whatever the hell that is. I spend most of my time reading or watching videos where you have the selection of what you want, and you can see the type of film that you want. I mean, if you just want to see, like my wife just watches what she calls chick flicks. So it's always, what's that English guy that's in all those films?
Oh.
Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant.
Yeah. I said, doesn't this guy, what does he make, like 10 movies a year or something like that? But anyway, you know what she says? She says, the world is so awful that there is so much violence and destruction. She said, this is just pure escape. She was just watching one. I don't think it was with Hugh Grant. It was with John Cusack.
I love John Cusack.
Must Have Dog or something like that?
Oh, Must Love Dogs.
Must Love Dogs.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet.
She loved it. She would recommend it.
Yeah.
It was kind of cute. I saw a little.
Well, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I've been watching TV more over the last 6 months because I was in the middle of nowhere in Wisconsin for a while.
Uh-huh.
And so I've watched a lot more of stuff I normally wouldn't. Usually I'm the same type of person. I read. I read as much as I possibly can. I read when I get up in the morning. I read when I go to bed. I read on my lunch breaks at work.
Yeah.
You know, I just read. And I even read on commercial breaks during TV shows.
There you go. Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I just love reading, but I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because I've gone from the middle class to being poor as dirt to back to being on my feet a little bit, back and forth and that, but I just see how people treat each other. And I was always picked on in school and stuff. And I mean, it was pretty bad when I was younger even, but I think it's gotten even worse over time. I see some of the stuff on TV where these kids were like pretty much tortured. I'm like, I thought the stuff I went through was bad, you know?
Wow.
Here are these kids that are just, you know, I mean, kids are mean.
Well, they shouldn't be. I mean, I agree with you, Jennifer, that we could start just on the personal level with being a lot more decent to each other. All right, Jennifer, thanks for checking in from hell.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, bye-bye. And if you're just joining us, she lives in hell, Michigan. When she someone says to her, go to hell, she's I'm already there. Yeah. All right, we want to get these calls, and let's just, Brandon, let's just do these three calls, and then we will call it a night. All right, here is Nicholas. Nicholas, where are you calling from? You're on the air. You're on WRIF.
Hey, what's going on? I'm calling from Livonia.
No, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, honestly, I don't have any questions for you. I listen to your show a lot, but I actually do kind of have something to say that I want a lot of people to hear. So
please, go ahead.
I'm just your average sort of teenager, you know. I don't really know squat about politics. I don't try to stay active in the government or anything, but it gives me sort of an outside view of what the world is like. And I see people all over the place who are unhappy with the president, unhappy with the way that the government runs things. I mean, the good that the government does for our country at all is at a minimal right now.
Right.
And in the Constitution, we have the right that if the government is corrupt or if it doesn't satisfy us or our needs as a nation, to rise up and overthrow it and replace it with something that works. And I don't know why we as a nation would rather sit and just watch our world crumble apart because of our politics, why we wouldn't just get up and do something about it.
Well, I think it takes a long time to really make people rise up. If you think about some of these things, I mean, some of like the union movement that culminated in the 1930s, I mean, gee, people were struggling against how awful corporations and employers were probably for 70 or 80 years before we even got a handle on things, and now it's starting to slip away again. You know, I think the question's an excellent one, Nicholas, and I'm going to do something that I'm actually going to apologize for, but I really have to move on. I got to get two more calls real quickly before we end. So thank you for that, and I would say for somebody who's not a very astute observer, that was an astute remark, so I appreciate it. Thank you. And let's see, here is Jack Jackson Romeo. Jack, hi, it's Peter Werby on WRIF. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
You got a great show, whether it's educational or entertainment.
Well, I don't know.
Entertainment. It's the only thing decent on radio.
You know, I think of the person that's entertained the most by it is me.
Well, you are right.
Yeah, go ahead.
I wait every Sunday for your show. There's nothing on TV. There's nothing on TV, nothing on the radio. Football's over, so what's left?
Yeah, there you go.
But I listen to you all the time. And all I want to say to the people out there that are listening, they want to know what to do. I believe that the government is only going to be as good as its people.
There you go.
If the government's corrupt, maybe the American people are corrupt. I know it sounds bad to say that. We buy the majority of the diamonds in the world while people are starving all over the world. These women want diamonds. We buy the majority of the drugs in the world, don't we?
We sure do. You know what's interesting? I was just telling someone today, if you pick up the New York Times page 3, which is the right-hand page, the top right-hand corner of like an eighth-page ad, every single day, Tiffany's has bought that. So there's always diamonds and you know, all sorts of gold jewelry and watches for $6,000. And invariably, next to it, there is some photograph of intense human misery that is adjacent to it, and people just can't, apparently, don't make the connection. I mean, Tiffany, you would think would be embarrassed, but I figure they'd probably figure, what the hell. I got to get a last caller, and so I'm going to cut you short. Here is Stephen in West Bloomfield. Stephen, you got about 60 seconds, unfortunately. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. I'm a first-time listener.
Welcome.
I enjoy your program, but I was wondering if you had ever seen anything about what went on with the SEC approving AT&T and Southern SBC going through their merger.
Yeah, they just
spend millions of dollars breaking them up, only to seeing them go back again.
I hadn't thought about that. All right, you know what? I just looking at the time. I got to get these commercials in before 1 o'clock. So call us again on that, Stephen. Thanks for being our last caller and for bringing that up. I had never thought of that. It's a great point. All right, stay tuned. A couple of interesting interviews, including one about this kind of hot radioactive stuff down the road from us. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling, and I'll be back next week.
This is WRIM.com.
Tired of expensive phone bills? Standard phone service can cost a minimum.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Whoa, I thought I had some spots. All right, now I've got, what time is it? It's 1 o'clock, so I can do really unprofessional things now. I am going to, I have two interviews, and I can't tell from the way these are featured which is which. I promised Paul Gunter from Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And so I'm going to have to just take, it's like flipping a coin. If it's the wrong one, I'm just going to stop it. You can live with that. Let's see. Thank you very much for joining me. Most of us are still sort of reeling from the shock of what happened in West Virginia at that coal accident and those deaths that occurred. The ongoing oil wars, not only in the Middle East, also in Nigeria, where resources, in order to fuel the nuclear industrial chemical society we have, is a problem. And you notice I said nuclear. Well, there hasn't been a nuclear plant constructed in this country, in the United States, for over 30 years. But it's afoot again. And I want to bring back to our microphone someone who we haven't spoke to in quite a few years to talk about this. It's Paul Gunter from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service in Washington, D.C. And Paul has served as the director of the Reactor Watchdog Project since 1991. Paul, thanks for joining me again. It's a pleasure to speak with you once
more. Thank you very much, Peter.
You know, it's interesting that you and your project work as the regulatory watchdog on the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, and the nuclear power industry. Now, wait a minute. Isn't the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, supposed to be doing what you're doing?
Well, NRC has that acronym can also stand for Nobody Really Cares, the Nuclear Railroad Commission, and Never Really Concerned. What we've found, and what has been backed up by reports from the Government Accountability Office and the NRC's own Office of Inspector General, is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission continues to blur the line between protecting industry profit margins and public safety margins. This was very dramatically demonstrated back in 2002 with the discovery of severe corrosion in the reactor pressure vessel head at the Davis-Bessey Nuclear Power Station just 20 miles from Toledo, Ohio.
Just down the road from Detroit.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And right on Lake Erie, we were principal in that discovery through disclosures through the Freedom of Information Act, but basically in a nutshell, the First Energy Nuclear Corporation, which operates the Davis-Bessey Nuclear Power Station and Perry Nuclear Power Station, they basically put maintenance, surveillance, and testing for corrosion of the most primary safety component in the nuclear power complex, that being the reactor pressure vessel. They shelved the inspection while they prioritized a production agenda. More disturbing than this is that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is designated by Congress with a primary mandate for public health and safety, suppressed its own staff's judgment on evidence of corrosion of the Davis-Besse vessel, which is, you know, basically the pressure cooker itself, behind 2,000 pounds per square inch at 600 degrees Fahrenheit. And there had been cracks in penetrations in the vessel head that were allowing a corrosive borated coolant to leak out and was dripping on the vessel head for years. And it, this corrosive dripping, which went undetected, unmonitored, eventually ate a hole 6 3/4 inches of carbon steel.
Right. Well, Paul Gunter, before we get too far away from your major premise, I mean, this is incredibly startling, given the necessity of an industry that can't afford any mistakes. And suddenly there's a parallel here between what's happened over the recent years with mine safety and the failure to inspect and the cutback on safety assurances for the like coal mines and what's happening here. Is there a parallel?
Absolutely. It's the oldest parallel where where profit margins become and production margins become more important than human health and safety.
Well, you know, you said that earlier, and I mean, it just seems unbelievable to me. I mean, maybe I could see these guys looking the other way if we're going to sacrifice 12 miners, because I mean, besides needing a subordinate class that has to go underneath the ground in order to bring out coal, we also need a sacrifice class that occurs every once in a while and happens on a broad scale in coal mining in terms of overall health and black lung. But we're talking here, nuclear power, we're talking about something could go wrong. I mean, Chernobyl at Toledo, I mean, hey, that would be kind of bad for everybody within, what, 1,000 miles?
Well, it would be bad for the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
It would be bad for Canada.
So why are these, I mean, how could they be this short-sighted? I mean, they don't.
Well, again, you know, as the documents reveal, the staff itself had safety concerns. This particular reactor, which is a Babcock and Wilcox pressurized water reactor, there are 7 of them in the country. 6 of those 7 had already evidenced this same kind of cracking and corrosion. And so the NRC staff knew that there was a high probability that this same cracking, leakage, and corrosion was occurring at the Davis-Besse nuclear power station. They drafted an order to shut the plant down immediately for inspection. Senior management at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission intervened at the 11th hour after talking with First Energy officials and shelved the order.
Huh.
This was also coupled with the fact that you know, while these revelations came out in 2002, the NRC had photographs in April of 2000 that showed corrosion roiling off, you know, just a lava flow of rust flowing off of the top of this reactor vessel. They were having to change out containment filters every day because of iron oxide in the containment atmosphere. It was collecting on the railings and on the steps and on the catwalks.
Yes. Well,
there was clear evidence that severe corrosion was going on, and yet production of electricity through the most inherently dangerous way of boiling water was allowed to continue, so that this the same documents that reveal this issue, reveal a meeting between NRC officials and company officials where the company says, don't give us this order. It's going to have bad financial impact.
Wow. Well,
and that, you know, again, you know, the where the this coal mine accident, and the backlog of safety issues, you know, demonstrates this callous disregard for human life. We're seeing this on an industry-wide, government-wide level with the nuclear power issue.
Paul Gunter, what does the Nuclear Regulatory Commission say, the NRC? Do they go, oh, well, Gunter's got us? I mean, do they admit to errors in this?
They essentially dismissed their involvement. The NRC official that was implicated, you know, as a senior management that signed off on delaying the inspections, squelching the staff's order, was given a raise. Huh. That's unfortunately the mission plan for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in fact, is the same as it was for the Atomic Energy Commission, which was abolished because it had a very cozy relationship with the industry that it was supposed to regulate. And David Spessy is not an isolated example where promotion of an industry agenda supersedes this supposed mandate for protecting public health and safety.
Now, as I said in the introduction, in fact, that I learned from your website, which is NIRS.org, and I'll have that on my website as well, that there hasn't been a new nuclear plant cited since the early 70s. And what people should be aware, too, what you're essentially talking about is a tea kettle, right? We're boiling water to run these reactors, but it's done with nuclear fuel. Is this on the agenda? Bush again is saying, "Hey, you don't like dependency on foreign oil? Let's go nuclear." Makes some sense in his world.
Well, you know, the Bush administration. Let's be clear: the Cheney Bush administration has long identified itself as a champion of. Let's put new meaning to GOP, gas, oil, and plutonium. this is the situation that's clearly been identified where they are a champion of the oil and fossil and nuclear industry. There were a whole series of closed door meetings that locked out energy efficiency and renewables and conservation groups in favor of gas, oil, and plutonium. And they have now proposed what they call a nuclear renaissance, what in fact is a nuclear relapse to a failed policy of the 1950s. There have been no new orders, as you've pointed out, since 1973 that were ever completed. There have been no new orders, period, since 1978. And this industry now, particularly with, the Abramoffs and others that hold sway, but are losing their credibility on Capitol Hill. They managed to lobby an energy bill in Congress that provides for a more than $13 billion giveaway to what Forbes magazine described in 1985 of the nuclear industry in a cover story entitled "Nuclear Follies," and what they identified was this is that the nuclear industry has been the largest managerial disaster in business history, and now
they don't have to pay for the mistakes, obviously, right?
There have been the government has provided an umbilical cord from the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. taxpayer to subsidize this industry, they had to rehook up this umbilical cord essentially jumpstart this all but moribund nuclear industry. And now we're faced with as Richard Nixon proposed, we would have 1,000 nuclear power stations by the year 2000. In fact, we only have 103 operating today. That should be some statement as to the market viability of this industry. But of more concern, particularly in a post-9/11 environment, these things represent pre-deployed weapons of mass destruction. Beyond the marketability or the unmarketability and the lack of economics of this most dangerous way to boil water, we also see these things as potential and growing targets. This was most recently outlined in a report by the National Academy of Sciences as directed by Congress and publicly released in April of 2005. And what they've identified is that, in particular, the irradiated nuclear waste that is stored on site at these nuclear power stations is an uncomprehensible target. Let me give you an example.
You mean like a terrorist target?
For terrorism,
yeah.
For, you know, whether it be Al-Qaeda or, a Timothy McVeigh wannabe. Let's just look at the Fermi nuclear power station in Monroe, Michigan, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That particular design, which is a General Electric boiling water Mark I nuclear power plant, all of the nuclear waste that has ever been generated at the Fermi nuclear power station sits in a 30-foot swimming pool on the roof of the building, behind a sheet metal wall and roof. And this is pointed out by the National Academy of Sciences as well, is that these elevated pools containing hundreds of metric tons of high-level nuclear waste, were it penetrated by an aircraft or by some other type of ordnance, would cause tens of thousands of cancers hundreds of miles away. This is by the National Academy of Sciences. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear industry continue to ignore this type of vulnerability.
Well, let me back up even, if you will. In fact, let me reintroduce you. This is the Peter Werby Show, and my guest is Paul Gunter. And Paul is the director of the Reactor Watchdog Project of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. And it's NIRS.org. This is scary stuff, because I'll tell you, Paul, whenever I've debated on some of my talk shows with people that think, oh, we'll have energy independence if we go nuclear, I say, how are you going to get rid of the waste? And there's always a little, and they'll say, well, we'll figure out a way, right? So I didn't know that. Down at Fermi, too, not so far. I mean, people in Monroe are listening to this right now. There is this volatile nuclear waste that has to be kept secure for, 200,000 years or
something? Time immemorial.
Time immemorial. Longer than civilization has existed.
Certainly, if the pyramids were nuclear waste disposal sites, they would be dangerously radioactive today.
Sure. So, and that ultimately is where it all breaks down on. And this supposed site in Nevada, remind me the name of it, Paul.
Yucca Mountain.
Yucca Mountain, yeah.
90 miles from Las Vegas.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, although yucca makes a nice plant, it's also a little colloquial phrase for something distasteful. Yuck.
It also happens to be site of some of the youngest volcanoes, the Lathrop Well cinder cones, in the United States, in North America. These young volcanoes ring this supposed site that for up to 70,000 metric tons of high-level radioactive waste. There are earthquake faults that crisscross the proposed repository. There is volcanic ash that has been that's in evidence within these fissures. There's groundwater seeping from the top of the, as rainwater is coming into the repository, where the new Department of Energy design would put a drip shield over the waste canisters. The water would then be migrating out of these sites into underground aquifers. There is, as the Attorney General of the state of Nevada has put it, the siting of Yucca Mountain, which is the only site that's under consideration right now, and in a licensing proceeding before the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This is more akin to a political mugging than it is a scientific venture on how we're going to isolate some of the most poisonous toxins that mankind has ever generated for future generations that will not get one watt of this electricity, but all of the toxic liability.
Wow, that's amazing. And also what's amazing, we so see so little bipartisanship in Nevada. Republicans and Democrats are opposed to nuclear waste coming from all over the country. Transporting it there is a nightmare, coming from Monroe, Michigan, for instance. But Paul Gunter, even if we stopped nuclear power today, if the Nuclear Information and Resource Service had its way, you would go all around the country, hit the switches, and they'd all be down, and we'd still have this enormous amount of nuclear waste, of which we would do what with?
Well, you know, again, there is no solution. If I were an alchemist and could turn lead into gold, that's been a goal for, many centuries. We're faced with a similar kind of situation. There is no new alchemy for nuclear waste. But let's put it in more simple terms. If I'm a plumber and you've got a problem with your plumbing, the first thing I'm going to do is shut off the water. And in this nuclear waste stream, which is growing steadily every day, and without any known management technology, and in positions of vulnerability at over 100 sites around the country, the first thing to do is stop the generation. And clearly we could begin a Manhattan 2 project to begin to look at what to do with this stuff. But in fact, these are questions that begin to shed more light on the uneconomic ability of this toxic legacy, speak to the fact that that the power from renewables, coupled with energy efficiency and conservation, is certainly a more reasonable way to go for generating a sane energy policy in this country than to continue to build more of these vulnerable targets with more nuclear waste without a solution at costs that the market will not bear and that only can be subsidized through the U.S. taxpayer.
Now, Paul Gunter, you recently were on C-SPAN and you were across the table from a representative of the nuclear industry, and I'm sure he didn't just say, well, you got me there. Yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up, like Monty Python used to say. What assurances do they give us? What's their argument? How are we going to get rid of the waste? How are we going to make this economically feasible without being this another drain on taxpayers? What do they say about it all?
Well, the nuclear industry typically downplays safety concerns. First of all, they claim a record that ignores the Three Mile Island accident, ignores the Chernobyl nuclear catastrophe, and looks the other way from the many near misses that we've had, and also ignores the fact that as all of these reactors, as they get older, that the risk of a nuclear accident increases. It doesn't decrease, particularly in light of the fact that they're trimming costs now from maintenance, as evidenced by Davis Bessie and other near misses, that they're shortchanging safety regulations, and that...
Wait a minute. Now, I appreciate this, Paul, but you're giving, again, the arguments against them. I'm curious what they're saying. When you get down to it, let's give them the safety issue. Okay, nothing's ever happened. I know there's been a lot more deaths in the mining and exposure and all the tailings, all that stuff. It's a disaster. But one of the things, how do they say about getting rid of all this dangerous, toxic stuff that has to go on, be safe for a couple hundred thousand years?
Well, again, the nuclear industry believes that it can take Yucca Mountain, with their foot in the door, they certainly plan to not stop at 70,000 metric tons, which is the current model that is being evaluated. And once they would open a repository, they would enlarge it. And so the Yucca Mountain site, and you know, again, they would begin to look at more sites around the country, more likely in the eastern section, in granite, in salt, and they would be using the siting precedent in Nevada as you know, to set the due process for forced locations in these other sites.
Well, here's what occurs to me. If Paul Gunter is wrong, say, okay, we've got to shut it all down now, and we've got to work on what we've already created as waste, which is so toxic, and so there's no more nuclear power, and we have to depend, as you said earlier, on conservation and alternative sources, and you're wrong in a sense, but nothing, there's no harm done. If they're wrong, we've got irreversible problems, right?
Well, you know, we have problems now.
Yeah, I know.
The evidence is that according to five national laboratories, we could cut 47% of our demand for electricity now through energy efficiency and conservation, and at the same time improve our lifestyle through better refrigeration, more efficient air conditioning, more efficient motors, and all these applications of energy efficiency at residential, commercial, and industrial levels, and cut 47% of our demand. Now, that's the formula for a reliable approach to abating such issues as global warming. I mean, you know, the industry likes to offer nuclear power as the clean air energy,
sure.
Even though we know that in routine operations, they're emitting radioactive materials in accumulating in biomagnifying amounts into the atmosphere and into our water and into our food chain. I mean, to say that we're going to abate global warming through nuclear power is a little like going to your doctor with a smoker's cough and being prescribed heroin. To change...
Well, you know what, Paul? We're actually out of time. There's so much more here. We are getting literally the tip of the iceberg, and we are the Titanic. Unless there is great changes made in this new Bush drive towards resurrecting nuclear power. It's time to drive a stake into its heart, and Paul Gunter and the Nuclear Information and Resource Service can help, but it's got to help communities. And I know a lot of you are listening in Monroe, and over the years there's been great activity down there to stop Fermi 2. It might be a time to, as they get ready to resurrect things, same thing with you folks. But it's a problem throughout the country. You can go to NIRS.org for more information. Paul Gunter, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you very much, Peter. We appreciate it. Look forward to the next time.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919.
This is WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the
the right to substitute any price for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Well, George W. Bush has started off 2006 saying that one of his great achievements has been the rebounding of the economy. Everybody's doing well. All you have to do is look at the stock market. I was looking at a few articles online. There's a car called a Bugatti Veyron, $1,400,000. Another article about mixed drinks that go from $50 up to, are you ready for this, $950 for a mixed drink, and on and on and on like that. When I go walking up through an upscale suburb next to mine, everybody's expanding their houses, so things are looking good. On the other hand, we see all these statistics that says people aren't doing so well. It's almost like there's an economic apartheid. Remember apartheid from South Africa, where there's separate lives for two classes of people? Well, lo and behold, here's a book right in front of me called Economic Apartheid in America, a primer on economic inequality and insecurity. It's written by Chuck Collins, who's a senior program developer at United for a Fair Economy, and we've spoken with him before, and Felice Yeskel. She is the co-director of Class Action, faculty member in the Social Justice Education Program at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and she and Chuck are co-founders of United for a Fair Economy and Responsible Wealth. And we are speaking to Felice Yeskel in Amherst, Massachusetts. Thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hey, are we on board with the pronunciation, apartheid and primer? You could say apartheid
that's
and primer.
I tend to say apartheid, but I'm not sure of the correct pronunciation.
How about primer or primer?
I could go either way on
okay.
that one.
Okay. All right. That's a pretty serious charge that there's actually economic apartheid in America. We've been raised on these stories of class mobility. What do you see in your book, Economic Apartheid in America, that doesn't meet up with the American myths?
Well, you know, one of the chapters in our book is Economic Boom for Whom? And the good news you were saying at the beginning of the show, well, it's true, but there's one thing we have to add. For whom? The economy is growing, but who is benefiting? The economy is good for those at the top 5% of income earners or wealth holders, and it's getting to be a meter and meter, harder and harder place to survive for the rest of us. The American dream is becoming the American pipe dream. And how come I say that? Well, look at the following. If you look at incomes, what most of us who don't have independent wealth rely on for paying our bills, if we look at median income, the hourly wages of average workers, you know, the people smack dab there in the middle, the hourly wages of average workers are 11% lower now than they were back in 1973 when Richard Nixon was president, once you adjust for inflation. And that is despite rising productivity, rising profits, and rising CEO pay. So what we're finding is, yeah, Bush can claim credit for having created more jobs, but the question I have is, what kind of jobs? You know, there's a bad joke that goes, you know, we've created 200,000 new jobs. Yeah, I know there are lots of jobs. I have three of them.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, a lot of middle-class people, a lot of listeners might think, well, yeah, I've heard statistics similar to that, but I'm doing okay. In fact, I just got a raise, or I haven't suffered any of the part of the downswing, and it looks okay to me from where I'm sitting here in my suburban neighborhood.
Well, you know, that may be true for some. And unfortunately, for many middle-class households, they are just one medical crisis, one outsourced job, or one busted pension away from bankruptcy. The economic insecurity that has routinely been felt by people at the bottom of the economic spectrum has crept quite far up. So even folks who are upper middle class are feeling the pinch. They're feeling the pinch a lot in terms of time. People are having to work more to make ends meet. It used to be one income could support a family. Now oftentimes it's two people in a household working. It used to be one job could do it. Now sometimes it's two. So take your upper middle class family who, you know, lives in a nice suburb in a house that they own some of and the bank owns some of. You know, they are oftentimes spending hours commuting to their jobs, flying around the country, not having much time with their family, not having much time for themselves, feeling like they have to be on a tether 24/7 with their Blackberries and their Palm Pilots and their cell phones and their portable fax machines. You can do business on vacation at the beach.
Sure.
So even those who are economically doing well seem to have suffered a real diminishment in the quality of their lives. And that is the minority. For people in the middle, we are feeling more insecure because we are having to work more to make up for the fact that wages are stagnant, or we're going deeper in debt.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to be a nation of savers. and now we are a nation of people deeply in debt. So what we are really doing is mortgaging our future retirement, our kids' future college fund, to make ends meet now. And part of what, you know, sometimes people think, well, you know, people should just, you know, stop wanton spending. Well, unfortunately, two paychecks, households are struggling to afford things like houses, colleges, health care, and retirement. It's not that we're buying so much. It's that some of the basic necessities have gone way up in price. The hot real estate market, if you want to buy a house, and health care, if you're lucky enough to have health insurance, you're no doubt paying more for it now than you were 5 years ago.
Police, Yesko, there's probably a half hour in about 20 of the sentences that you mentioned. I hardly know where to begin. Let's try, though. You hear that idea we're all one paycheck away from, some people even say from.
Hi, this is Doug Podell. Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. Don't forget, while you're online, to check out the Riff Concert page. It's the Motor City's best for complete rock concert information. For more details, just click on the Riff banner on your Windows Media Player.
Care. People go deep in debt because they can't pay their hospital bills. They can't pay their doctor bills. I think that we are at the end of the limits of, you know, little fixes. I think that we need a real systemic way of dealing with a crisis in healthcare. You know, in my little town, Amherst, Massachusetts, we're talking about having to lay off something like 18 teachers next year because they only could raise taxes, but so far, and they don't have enough income to make up for the fact that the health care payments that the town has to make for all the town workers and teachers, the firefighters, the police force, the health care premiums have gone up so much that they can't pay for them, so they have to cut jobs.
Hmm. Now, you know, I think, fortunately, this is getting to be an issue that even 5, 6, 7 years ago was not on the agenda when it was tried by the Clinton administration early in the 90s. It didn't go very far. But the crisis is, it's unfortunate. We always have to get to a crisis to focus our attention on this. My guest is Felice Yeskel. She is the co-author of Economic Apartheid in America, a primer on economic inequality and insecurity. Let's go back a little to myths. We were talking about the Horatio Alger myth, that pulling oneself up by their own bootstraps. And a lot of people, I mean, we see the increasing number of poor people, on the other hand, the increased amount of wealth. Pardon me. But some people think, well, that's the natural functioning of the system. This is what creates a great and powerful society. You have the best rising to the top through economic struggle. And if people want to get out of the situation they're in, they should take advantage of what is available in this society that allows people to rise within the class structure. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respond that it is a myth. It was more true at a different period in our economic history than it is today. But currently, we have a greater belief in class mobility in the United States and a worse ability to actually move than many industrialized countries. So if you're lucky enough to be born poor in Great Britain or Canada or lots of other of the industrialized European countries, you have a much better time, an easier time of moving up the class spectrum than if you're born poor in the United States. Yes, there is some class mobility. It's not like nobody does, but statistically speaking, we have a much worse chance of rising, economically speaking, here in the United States than in many other countries, and a worse chance now than you did a generation ago. Those are the facts. The belief, on the other hand, in the American dream, the myth of class mobility, is much stronger than ever.
That's so interesting. Well, I mean, why are we, in your estimation, in this state of denial?
You know, that is a very good question. I wish I knew. I think that part of it is that we as a country have bought a lot of myths about class. First is that class doesn't exist here in the United States. We're a classless society. Oh, well, if we do have class, we're all middle class. Oh, okay, maybe there are a few lucky rich ones and a few unfortunate poor ones, but basically we're all middle class, right? Class remains one of the last great taboos, a dirty five-letter word, something we just don't talk about. And when you don't talk about something, a lot of misinformation or mythology is allowed to grow. And so what we do here in this country, if we don't make it, which many of us don't or we have a harder time doing, is we tend to
sort of losing you here. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. We either blame ourselves, we blame each other, or we buy lottery tickets. And we engage in some fantasy that lets us believe that someday we're going to make it.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I've had people, when I've talked about issues like this on shows where I've had call-ins, that people say, if I listened to you, in other words, to me, I wouldn't have any, what's the one they always have, what's that that quality that they have to succeed? In other words, that sort of saying what you're saying, or and I wish I could remember what I said, was that you have to have that sense that you can make it. Or you can't do
right.
it. But I mean, I always say it. Sometimes it's like a poor kid in the ghetto dreaming about being a basketball star. Sure, a few of them do wind up being greats, and in the main, it ain't going to happen.
Right. I think that it's very hard. You don't want to tell an individual, look, give up your dreams, forget it. You're not going to get anywhere. You want people to, you know, have hope and have a vision for their lives and work hard to meet goals, of course. But part of the problem is that we way overemphasize individual initiative and individual traits, and we way underemphasize the social conditions, the structure, the economic policies. You know, a kid one generation ago had a much better chance of succeeding than a kid today does. Kids today are leaving college more deeply in debt, with less prospects for good employment. Yes, some do graduate and get fantastic jobs. Hopefully your kid will be one of them. But as a group, economic conditions have changed due to the changes in the rules governing our economy to make it harder.
I don't think I'm talking out of school to say that my guest Felice Yeskel has a cold. That's why, and I'm sharing her misery, even though we're far away. Felice is in Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm in Detroit, but I guess it's affecting us all. Well, let's look at two countries. Now, we have the wealthiest country in the world in terms of aggregate wealth, the United States. And then we can look at another country, say in Scandinavia, Denmark or Norway or Sweden, and the class differences seem extraordinarily different. They have these enormous social structures that deal with health and all sorts of other social welfare programs. You know, the people work less. Their incomes are higher. What's happening? How can they do that and we don't?
Well, one lesson I take from that is that the way we organize our economy is not inevitable. It's not a result of sunspots. It's not an act of God. People have made these choices, and people can change the way the rules work. Other countries make different choices. We in the United States made different choices at different historical periods. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, when I was growing up, we had a more economically equal society. We didn't have as much of a spread. When the economic pie grew, every part of our society got a share of that growth. Over the last 25 years, starting really in around 1980 when Reagan came to office based on a new economic philosophy, that of trickle-down or Reaganomics or supply-side economics, the belief there was let people at the top keep more of their money. They will take that money and invest it. That will grow the economy and create more wealth for everyone, a la trickle-down. Well, unfortunately, trickle-down did not work. Instead, what we got was gush up. Wealth more and more concentrated in fewer and fewer people's hands. we could rewrite the tax policies, rewrite the spending policies, rewrite a lot of the things that we currently have changed under Reagan, Bush 1, and Bush 2 to create more economic equality if we wanted to. And other countries have chosen to organize their economy that way. It may be that the choice that they're making is that a handful of people don't get fabulously wealthy beyond our wildest imagination, but everybody does a lot better.
My guest is Felice Yeskel. She and Chuck Collins have written the book, Economic Apartheid in America, a primer on economic inequality and insecurity. A primer, that is kind of a simple look at usually what is pretty difficult to understand. So a lot of charts and cartoons, and it's the kind of thing where if you didn't want to, you know, go too, and in a lot of ways I think it's true, you don't have to go too deeply into the dismal science to get the information that we need about our lives. In other words, we're not interested in economic theory per se. We're interested in how does the economy affect our lives, what role do we have in it, what forces control our lives and that of our families and communities. This is a great place to start. It's published by The New Press. You can go to thenewpress.com. You know, we were talking earlier about myths and about Horatio Alger, and I was thinking about the Forbes list of the richest 400, and particularly the top 10, because it's always, you know, thought of these people have risen to the top by themselves. But I was thinking of at least five of the top 10. And there's a number in there that have, but five of the top 10 just got it through inheritance from when Sam Walton passed away.
Yeah, you know. We did, United for a Fair Economy years ago did a study of the Forbes 400 because they make the claim, you know, these are self-made people that worked hard and got themselves onto this list, therefore anybody can do it. And we examined the sources of the wealth of people on the Forbes 400 list and found that the majority of people on that list, while they didn't necessarily inherit their way onto the list, they inherited assets of $1 million or more. Now, they may have grown those assets into billions, and sure, they should get some credit for that, but it's not true that they started out, you know, with nothing and, you know, were rags to riches. So we called it, I think, born on third base, the idea being, you know, they were born on third base and they thought they hit a triple.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
I like it.
Indeed, they were born with a lot of assets and a lot of economic and social privilege, a lot of connections, a lot of all sorts of things that helped them do well. They did very well, and they deserve some credit, but the society as a whole also deserves some credit. All of the institutions of society are set up to benefit privileged people at the expense of others. And a lot of times we just take the privilege that we have for granted. It's important to start to see that invisible privilege. The myth of I did it alone renders completely invisible the collective institutions that make security and wealth possible. The myth of self-sufficiency is not true.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, Detroiters listening can just, and people around the country, big cities, whenever a stadium is built, say with rarely are they built solely with private funds. There's always, very frequently, public matching funds. And then there's this great infrastructure redesign and development that that you and I wind up paying for. We just have a few minutes left with you, Felice Yeskel. And I was thinking of a couple of things. First off, is taxes. Most people don't like taxes, and I don't blame them. We don't get much for it, wars and what have you. But whole tax structure seems to be so insane and so complex. Some people have put forth the idea, why don't we just everybody have like a 17% flat tax or a national sales tax, and that would take care of it. It would hit everyone equally. You talk about you know, a fair economy and equality. There it is. Absolutely. Everyone pays the same.
Well, you know, the same is not necessarily equal. It's real clear that if you have $1 million of income every year and you pay 10%, for example, that would be $100,000. But you could live quite well on $990,000. If you made only $10,000 a year and you pay 10%, you would be left with $9,000 to live on. It's already impossible to live on $10,000 a year. So one-tenth of a small income makes it much more difficult to survive than one-tenth of a very large income. The other thing is that's only talking about, so a flat tax is not necessarily a fair tax. We have a tradition in our country of a progressive tax structure that basically says if you earn more, you pay more. If you can do, you do it. We used to have a tradition that in good times, we all shared in the good times. When times got hard, we all tightened our belts. The last 25 or so years have been an exception to that. Here we are in a war. There are people who are giving their lives, making the ultimate sacrifice for our country, and meanwhile, wealthy people are getting tax cuts. They're not even paying the financial burden of the war. You have parents who are having bake sales to buy their sons and daughters Kevlar vests, and you have tax cuts for those who need them the least. That doesn't seem fair to me. I don't think the same dollar amount or the same percentage is necessarily fair. I think progressive taxation is fair. A flat tax or a sales tax basically penalize the people who could least afford it.
You know, this in many ways, this era is becoming reminiscent of the 1890s or the 1920s when we start talking about Bugattis that cost $1,400,000. You expect to see the Great Gatsby driving down in this guy out in California whose neighbors wouldn't allow him to build a 75,000 square foot home. But in those days, particularly in the 1890s, there were great movements of resistance to wealth in the cities, the labor unions, and in the countryside, in the South, and in the Midwest, there was the populist movement. There doesn't seem to be that kind of resistance anymore.
Well, every other time, Peter, that our nation's wealth was as concentrated in as few hands as it is today, popular movements arose to change the rules of the economy. And that last time wealth was this concentrated was in 1929, the eve of the Depression. And the 1930s did see a tremendous amount of organizing. And, in fact, a lot of the programs that created a social safety net, things like Social Security. And I have a bumper sticker on my car that says, the labor movement, the folks who brought us the weekend. People organized to get, the eight-hour day. They organized to get weekends off. They organized against child labor. Any advance that we have gotten in society has happened because people came together and worked to make that happen. I believe we do see some evidence of that happening today. I think we see it in living wage movements around the country. I think the union movements are trying to revitalize themselves in a very difficult environment. I think we see on college campuses a lot of student labor action coalitions, a lot of anti-sweatshop organizing. I think all of these things are indications that people are getting fed up with the situation we find ourselves in today and believe that we can do better.
We should leave it at that because we're out of time. But Barbara Ehrenreich writes, terse, shocking, and richly documented economic apartheid in America is both an indispensable resource and a call to arms. The last part of it that we heard from our guest, Felice Yaskel, is a call to arms. It's essentially and ultimately up to us. The book is available from The New Press. You can go to thenewpress.com, or you can go to my website where I'll have a link as well. Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Felice Yaskel, thanks for joining me.
Peter, let me give one more website if I can.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I forgot. Go ahead.
Class Action, www.classism.org, and United for a Fair Economy, faireconomy.org. Links to the book from both of those sites as well.
And go have some chicken soup, please.
Thanks, Peter.
All right.
WRIF.com. The lowdown on the hottest concerts in town are only a click away with a singular wireless concert connection. Log on to the concerts page right now at WRIF.com to find out where your favorite bands are appearing live in concert across the Motor City. Keep it right here on the Riff for your chance to text in to win tickets, backstage passes, autographed rock merchandise, and more exclusively on your singular wireless phone. The singular wireless concert connection from Singular Wireless, raising the bar at 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Want to get to the next level of your career? If working harder at your job won't help, work smarter by earning a bachelor's or master's degree at University of Phoenix.
the nation's largest accredited private university. It's college designed for busy working adults. In most cases, you can earn a degree in only 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classes are designed for working adults with busy lives. You'll cover more material in less time with convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. Call now for a brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more. 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any price for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48222.